Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's July 18th, 2014. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
I'm Scott Long. You're almost back, buddy.
Yeah, my vacation's over. Actually, this is the actual day I'm coming back.
Oh, okay.
All right. Man, I'm sad my vacation's over. You should have seen that one pastry chef in France that I dealt with, man.
It was
a pastry chef. Dude. I dealt with other people, but this guy, he really got on my nerves. But I'll tell you,
scrolling some European forums, and I'm sure your name's showing up on a bunch of them.
This guy's trying to sand the pastry chef.
We are in, this is our last of our classic retelling shows on the binge while Chris is in Europe. Next week we will be back with our regular normal show, O'Malley's Move, all that kind of great stuff. So enjoy your last classic episode this week. And this is a good one. I don't know if it's as good as the other ones, but I think it's emblematic of an important part of our show's culture, right?
Yeah, yeah. But hands down. Hands down, overwhelming winner as far as, you know, votes go. This was overwhelming, the winner that, and we'll just tell you right now, it's Greg Raymer discusses Badoogie.
Yeah.
It came from July 5th, 2012. The other thing too, I got a little confused. I wasn't sure if this was the episode, but it had to be the episode because he actually talks about how to play Badoogie on this episode. And that's what I was asking for, because he was on the show years before that,
right?
And it was March of it was like right around your anniversary, isn't it? Or
birthday.
And it was 2007, and he did a hand. We did a hand of the week Badoogie with him because we knew he liked Badoogie, and somebody sent one in, so we saved it for him. So I thought maybe that might have been the show, but it wasn't. It was clearly this one.
I think it was that show that encouraged us when we decided 5 years later to do a show of Badoogie. We're like, we got to have Greg Raber come on.
Yes, that's
and
exactly
do this, right because. Yep. He did such a great job with that hand on that first one. Obviously, this guy knows the game. And really, not a lot of people have been writing about Badoogie at that point. In fact, actually, I don't even know how many people are writing about Badoogie now, a couple of years later.
That's right.
So, I mean, to find somebody that could really explain it was hard, and we knew this guy could, right? And we knew he was always easy to get a hold of and a good guy, so that made sense to get him on. So, really, I think this show kind of intersects two things that I think are really important for the culture of our show. One, fans have always liked us having pros on to dissect their hands of the week, and then they also love the fact that we talk about games other than No Limit Hold'em, and we introduce them to these other games and broaden their poker horizons and their poker muscles. And so this show kind of encapsulates both of those things. You know, we had a great celebrity pro guest, and it was a game that's as far away from No Limit Hold'em as you can get.
Yeah, and you got to remember, too, we even had, like, Let's Play Raz buttons, because people just love the fact that we introduced them to games that they never would have even thought of playing or even knew existed, like this one, Badoogie. And that was, like, our mantra. That was it. We were known for that. And that's why we called ourselves Ante Up, because it wasn't going to just be No Limit Hold'em. Eventually, it was going to be, you know, about games with antes and everything else. So we were fortunate that, you know, that Greg agreed to be on the show that first time and then remembered us for the second time. And I always got, even though I, you know, in this business, you get to meet a lot of popular and famous people.
Sure.
You know, and I don't mean poker. I mean in journalism. I mean, over the years when I was covering sports, I met, you know, everybody from, you know, comedians to actors to politicians. And then, of course, the actual stars of the sport that you're covering and stuff. And so, but even now when I get Raymer on the phone or something, you know, for something like this. You get a little nervous. You get a little like, holy cow, I'm talking to Greg Raymer. I remember how nervous I was when we had Johnny Chan on, and you weren't even nervous. I'm like, Scott, we're talking to Johnny Chan. This is Johnny effing Chan. He's from Rounders. I mean, he's a world champion twice over. You're not, and he's like, call him up. I'm like, what? Where, you know, I mean, I'm not awestruck like that. It was just amazing that we can get these guys on the phone because they were a lot more accessible than, say, Alex Rodriguez, you know, or you sure, couldn't, you can pick up the phone and call Derek Jeter, but you can get on the phone. And he was like, all right, well, where do I got to go? And I'm like, Johnny, we're calling you on the phone. You thought you had to drive to the show. He was going to drive to the show and do it, you know? And the same with Greg Raymer. I mean, he was so generous. He was just, he's a real proponent of the game. And whenever we needed him, he would come on the show. Or when I was out in Vegas, because there were a lot of times where I went out alone to cover the November 9 or the actual World Series itself, he was always accessible. I did Q&As with him. I asked his opinions on things. We ran his quotes in our stories and stuff. Just always a good guy, and always there for the game and for us. And that's why I'm glad he got voted in.
Yeah, I think it's I think some of the ways that these pro interviews work well for us is because I wasn't that fanboy for whatever reason. I've just, you know, trust me, there are celebrities I would die to meet. Anybody has to need a Ford's phone number, let me have it. And I'd probably, you know, start drooling and acting weird. But poker never seemed to be that way for me. I mean, I just always treated these people like anybody else I was interviewing. I can't really explain why that is, but I think that helps to be a little bit grounded because, you know, I listen to some of these shows, some other podcasts and stuff where people are interviewing people, and I guess all the hosts get so giddy that it's like the whole, you know, the Chris Farley classics on SNL, right? Yeah. Like, wow, that must be great. And they're terrible shows, right? Because you're not getting any information. So I guess for whatever reason, the fact that I just nonplussed about this, I guess probably helped some of these episodes. Not that you...
I wasn't gushing over them, but privately, I was telling you, this is awesome. This is huge for us. That was our first world champion then, and then he was our second world champion, Raymer. I mean, to me, it was just huge for the show. I was excited for the show, and I wanted it to go well. You know, I didn't want to embarrass ourselves. Because you got to admit, I mean, now we have all these, you know, poignant questions and stuff like that. But back then, you know, we had to make sure we came up with stuff that meant something. We were journalists, you know, right, and we were out of that reporting phase for a long time. We were editors for years. So to go back to, okay, now I got to figure out all these poignant questions to ask them and do the research. But we did. I mean, we did a lot of I know I remember coming up with a lot of questions for these guys that they were like, whoa, how do you remember that, or how'd you know that, or whatever. And it made them feel good. And when they say, oh, that's a good question, it always makes you feel good that, you know, you gave them something that they weren't droning on about for the last 10 interviews they did.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
And that was really cool. But that's why we appreciated him, because he was so generous with his time and his answers. And I remember the first time we interviewed him, he had to correct me on a couple of things because I don't know if I was reading it too fast or whatever, but I had said, you know, hey, you finished like, it's really cool to finish sixth. And he's like, yeah, fifth even. And I'm like, oh, you're fifth. It was something like that in the interview. And so he was just really generous that way too. He could have been a jerk about it, and he wasn't. He was cool. And I'm so glad he made the list, like I said, because this was a really good show, and people really want to hear. I think they want to learn about Badoogie again. That's why they want us to play it.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think I talked about this on the show, too, before. I mean, I guess part of it, well, I'm nonplussed, as I said, about meeting these folks. But the other thing is, I think once we really got into the business, I mean, not back when we were doing the podcast only, but once we got into the magazine and I started really meeting more pros and talking to them, the less I liked it.
Yeah.
I just it's so disappointing to me how many of these people turned out to be, I hesitate to say jerks, but just people that don't have any interest in talking to.
Right, not the people you'd want to hang out with.
Exactly, yeah. And there's probably half a dozen or so that have exceeded my expectations and have been people that I'm like, hey, this is a real deal. And Greg is one of those, and you know, I think that's why it's all that much more sad, the whole, you know, legal problem he had last year or so, because there's not too many of these people out there in this business that are genuine and giving of their time and articulate and willing to spend the time with folks like us for no reason. I mean, they're not chopping a book and that's why they're talking to us or something like that.
Yeah.
And he's one of them, and I just hated any kind of tarnish on his legacy. And, you know, I think that the time's passed now, and, you know, people certainly remember that, but I don't think it's that big a deal anymore. So, and I'm kind of glad for that, because he's just one of the poker's good guys.
Yeah. I remember when I found out about that, I was just heartbroken. I felt so bad for his legacy, you know, and for everything. But you know, you move forward. That's, and America thrives on stuff like that, you know. Where,
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, where you rally around somebody who's, you know, turned their life around or made a fix a problem that they had, and they like the underdog. So, you know, I was just grateful that he was on the show with us when he was, and he remembers us when we talk to him, and that kind of thing. And I wish him the best, and I'm really glad that this has made the list, and it's our last one. So,
yeah. And then what a great game Badoogie is too. I mean, it's I really this is a game I really really enjoy playing. It's not when I'm hankering or if it doesn't get called in the home game I'm upset, but when it gets called, I'm like, all right.
Well, you know it's going to get called if Gambit's in the game. He's going to call Badoogie. He's always going to call
just such
PLO,
a great game.
It is.
It's just such a different game from anything else we play, you know. Obviously, I'm a huge Omaha fan. Omaha, yeah, I love to play that all the time, and that's probably a more traditional poker game. I really don't think Badoogie is a carnival game. It's carnival atmosphere around it, I guess. But it's just so much fun because you got so many different things. You're trying to get these. We taught some people this on the transatlantic cruise too. And as soon as I got done teaching them, they shook their head and walked away. Oh, I'm never playing that again. You're like, so wait a minute. So I'm like, because some guy was dealt a king high Badoogie from the beginning. I'm like, that's a monster when you're dealt with a beginning. He's like, but it's a king high. I'm like, I know, but everybody else is trolling. And like, forget it. There's just so much to it that makes it so much fun. And, you know, once I started playing this, I really didn't really enjoy Deuce to Seven that much. And I think you actually prefer Deuce to Seven to Badoogie, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that's true.
And, but it's just such a different game. And I'm glad that we introduced this to people and people play it in their home game now. And, had Greg just really explain it perfectly on the show.
And that's the beauty of having these pros on. And we've talked about it before, too, with, you know, Negreanu and the way they just grasp everything. And they're not sitting there writing it down on a notepad like I am. They got it all committed to memory because it's just second nature to them. And it's just so impressive. And it just shows you how horrible you are at poker.
Oh, my gosh, absolutely.
When you hear these people talk and you're like, God, I wouldn't even have thought of that. Or how'd you know that? Or how'd you remember that? Or there's so many rules to keep in your head and so many situations. And they have it all in there. And he does it so well. Greg Raymer is just such a great – and that's why he was always part of those WSOP academies and all those boot camps and stuff, because he's such a great teacher, and he just understands it all. And so this is a perfect example of that. And it was part of our Power Tips, right?
That could have been it, yeah.
Yeah, it was our segment for Power Tips when we had the Ape series. Whenever we were doing a new game, we'd always have 10 or 5 tips on how to play those games. And so we had him on, I think, for the Power Tips to show everybody how to play Badoogie for the upcoming tournament. And obviously it didn't rub off too well on me because I don't think I did well in Badoogie. But it's a tough game to play. It really is, because it's kind of like Raz, where you never really have a hand. And then when you do have a hand, you're never really happy with it, unless it's the absolute nuts. You know, and it doesn't feel like poker when you're playing it, to me, sometimes. It is. It's obviously poker. You got to know a lot of things that are poker-related. It doesn't feel like poker to me. But it is.
It's one of those things where you got to remember, you know, I think where people lose it when they're learning is that it's this, I'm trying to get ace, deuce, three, four different suits.
Yeah.
And the goal for them is to get a best hand, and it's not. You got to remember that other people are drawing, and if you're standing pat, you're forcing them to probably draw more than they should. And so there's a lot of deception and stuff in it. And then deciding when to break at the end, if somebody's caught up or not, it's kind of like a game of chicken, but not so much in the no limit where it's just, you know, two guys showing who's got the biggest stack. It's a little different, but it's still like a restrained game of chicken, I guess.
No limit Badoogie.
No, it's not.
Well, I mean, that's what it's like, the single draw. You play no limit single draw Badoogie.
And that's why I don't like that.
Yeah, I know you don't like that. But it is a fun game, and if you understand the nuances of position with this game and with understanding what it means if they're drawing and you're pat, what the odds are and all that stuff, then it's a beautiful game, because then it's not about the cards, it's about the situation, and so it becomes poker again. It's just sometimes when you're playing, you're like, God, this is not poker. I keep drawing a spade, and I've got, you know, I mean, it's frustrating too, but that's what makes it beautiful too, because when it finally works out, you know, it's magical. And he really gets to the heart of it here. So here we go. This is from July 5th, 2012. World champion Greg Raymer discusses Badoogie.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Annie Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's July 6, 2012. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Yankee Doodle Dandy Scott Long.
Why? Because it was July 4th a couple of days ago?
Yeah,
what,
July 4th
is this?
A couple of days ago. Yeah, I'm proud to be an American.
Oh, man.
Even
I watch a lot of fireworks.
Lee Greenwood once a year.
Does that make me an American? I watch a lot of fireworks.
It might have. You know, I felt bad. I was working all last night, and I missed all the fireworks. You know, I went to the Threshers game on Tuesday and saw a fantastic show. So it's not like I missed them. But,
right.
But I just got busy last on the 4th and heard them going off. I'm like, oh, I should walk out. But I didn't. And instead, I went to go see Ted, which was good, you know.
Yeah, we both saw Ted this week.
There's no better way to celebrate our independence as a nation than laughing at a foul-mouthed talking teddy bear.
The only thing missing was no poker in the movie. There should have been poker.
No, absolutely, yeah. The guy is full of sin.
I know.
There should have been at least one scene where they're check-raising Teddy Ruxpin for cookies or something.
Yeah. It was funny, though. A lot of stuff. You know what I like most about Seth MacFarlane stuff most of the time is that we're about the same age.
Yes.
So all of his jokes are the jokes that, you know, I'm supposed to get, and I do, and it's all the movies that he likes, all the things that he likes, are the things that I grew up with and like, too, and that's what I like most about it. We're starting to come into our own when it comes into, you know, people making decisions in Hollywood, you know, so it's kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree.
But speaking of sin, we
this
just
is
got back.
Show. I always got to reel you in, Chris.
You know, you gotta keep me under wraps there, buddy. I'm wild and crazy. But we had a great trip out there, the Las Vegas. It went by very quickly, actually.
It did, actually,
for
yes.
That part of it did. Although, what made it drag, we'll find out a little later on, was Scott on the phone every day with a particular company. We'll get to that in a minute. But we had a lot of fun. And then you, of course, went on to a couple of other destinations while I came home and started working on getting the magazine together. So, a lot in store for today.
Yeah. And there were a couple things that happened during this trip I don't think really need to fit into the road trip thing because they weren't really specific to the region too much. But I thought they were interesting poker things to talk about, and we haven't recorded a show here in 2 weeks, so kind of stored them up a little bit. So let me fire them at you and see what you think about them. You know, the first is we did have our meetup at Isle Black Hawk in Colorado, and we'll talk more about that on a future show when we do it. But there was a situation where a player asked for a new setup. All right, now, we've talked about this on the show before, too, just how annoying this is.
Yeah.
It's all superstitious and just a big waste of time, right? But I've never seen a room say no. And this room said no. And they said that is their house policy. It's not to replace setups. Though, you know, I didn't ask, but I'm sure, obviously, if the card is marked or something, they would. But not just because, you know, somebody's got a little hair on the back of their neck. And that's exactly why they said. They're like, there's no reason to do a setup other than superstition, and it slows down the game for other players, and you know, let's be honest, slows it down for the house as well too.
Yep.
So I have to say, rejoice!
Rejoice.
A brief moment of common sense in the poker world.
Nah, it doesn't automatically though make you think that the guy who wants the new setup is just going to ding a card and say, "Look, this card needs to be replaced."
Well, probably.
I mean, really, and I think that's kind of and forgive me, Andy Block, if I'm getting this wrong, but a few years ago when the cards were terrible at the World Series. And everybody was complaining about him. I think Andy Block like intentionally ripped a card or something to get the deck out because it was a terrible deck. But that they had a good reason to do it. But here,
yeah, that's a little different, right? Yeah.
But somebody still could just be like, "Really, you don't want to give me a new setup? Okay. Oh, look at this, a folded card. Ah, oh, what a shame."
And I would imagine if it's a room that doesn't play these games with setups, they would probably just 89. That's it.
86 you, Scott.
86 you, yes. That was one of those numbers.
You had a few of the numbers in the right spots, but not exactly. 69 you. I can't believe
I
you just said that.
Yeah, but no, I have a flair for the dramatic, and I just messed things up.
That's going down in the Ante Up Hall of Fame right there, man.
But I'll tell you another funny thing about this, too, was the player that I asked was a dealer in another room. He ended up dealing to me the next night, which I thought was kind of funny. And he really didn't, you know, he's like, you know, I don't care when they told him, though. He was just, you know, frustrated with his cards and that kind of stuff. But the player next to him got up and left right after that and was in a 20-minute discussion with the floor who ruled against this about why that it was a terrible ruling.
Really? And it wasn't even him. It was just somebody else.
Yeah, and then we're like, this is weird. So the guy, you know, the guy that actually asked for the setup asked the floor. He's like, "Hey, was that guy complaining about the setup?" He's like, "Yeah." He's like, I was the one that asked for the setup. What was he upset about?
Jeez.
you know, this, you know, this is why poker players drive me crazy sometimes.
Oh, man.
All right, well, the other thing that drives me crazy, too, this happened at a different room in a different locale. But, you know, when you get up to go to the bathroom or smoke or something, if you missed your blinds, right, they give you the miss blind button.
Right.
And then if you want to come back in, you got to post, or you can just wait until the big blind comes around and not post. Or, I mean, post your normal big blind, right?
Right.
All right, so, you know, I want to preface this by saying people's money is their own money. They can do whatever they want with it. I'm not judging you for how you spend your money or how you do your money. But this struck me as pretty hilarious. So I was playing in a game where the blinds were $1, $2, right?
All right.
A guy missed both blinds. So to come in, you have to pay $3, right?
Right.
$2 for your big blind and then the dead small blind, right?
Right.
Or, like I said, you can wait your big blind and come in for $2.
Right.
All right? So it's a dollar difference, right? All right, now, you know, normally, no big deal. But in this particular room, there was a bad beat jackpot of $122,000. With a table share. I gotta wonder, and help me out here, there's cheap, and then there's really cheap.
Okay.
I mean, really, you're gonna sit out seven or eight hands where you have a potential of sharing in or even hitting $122,000 bad beat over a dollar? And sit there and watch the action, too. It's not like you went out and got another smoke or something or ordered lunch. You just sat there waiting to come back in. Am I wrong to think that's...
I don't know. I don't know. People just feel funny about posting and because they know their blind is coming again. So they're posting for the hands they missed that they didn't get to play because they're only going to play like four or five hands before they get to the blind again. So they're thinking I have to pay $5 or even $6 to play these four hands when I could post two and miss five or six. You know what I mean? So I know the $122,000 thing and all that, but that's how I... When I sit down and I think... All right, am I going to want to post $3 right now? Of course, you know what? I have to be honest. I don't think I've ever missed my big blind or blinds ever because I never leave the table.
Yeah, you don't drink enough beer.
No, I don't. I don't drink. So, like, literally, if I'm going to leave, I'm leaving. But I don't know. I see people do it all the time. They don't want to pay the $3 right away to start seeing hands and then pay $3 again when the blinds come around and four more hands. And they're going to feel like they paid $6 to see six hands. And they don't feel right about it. So, I mean, I know what you're saying, cheap and whatever, but I can see why they don't want to do that. And the odds of them hitting the bad beat in those one of four hands, it would kill them. But really, I think they play the odds and keep their money. That's why they do it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I see it all the time.
That's crazy odds.
Yeah, I see it all the time, though. You're making fun of it. But, I mean, all the time, I see people wait. They'll wait eight hands to get it before they have to, because they don't want to have to pay unless they have to pay, you know?
Well, and I also think again, this is a personal decision. I mean, the guy can do what he wants, but I think it goes beyond paying for hands. If you're in a good game, you're missing out on profit potential by not being in those four hands.
Yeah, so, but you didn't say it was a good game. You just say
Well, I know, but I mean, in general, that's the kind of stuff you got to consider. I mean, if you're taking this straight mathematical spreadsheet formula, like, hey, I'm not paying for hands, I'm not playing, then that's too narrow, I think. You got to consider, and, you know, here's the thing. It was a 2-6 spread limit game, I think.
Okay.
All right. You know, I mean, I guess I'm opening myself up to criticism from the you can't beat the rake people out there. But you know, if you're playing that game, you shouldn't be worried about beating the rake. You're there for recreation only.
Yeah.
You know, obviously you want to leave with more money than you came with, but you know, this is not a 10-20 limit game where you're trying to feed your family with, you know?
Yeah, nobody's making a living playing this game.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, why not just post and have some fun, and maybe you hit the bad beat, and then you have a great story. I mean, I guarantee you it's going to be a better story when the bad beat hits and you're not in there. Because you got cheap on me, or I'm not paying for those four hands. All right, Matlock, have fun. But all right, moving on. Now, this one I thought was the funniest thing that I've seen on the trip. I was playing in a tournament. And it was getting kind of late in the tournament. We were getting ready to go down to the final table. I think we had about 12 people left. And there were three people involved in the hand. There was a raise, and then a re-raise, and then an all-in. And the guy that went all-in flipped his cards up, and they were pocket jacks, right?
Right.
He didn't realize the third person hadn't acted yet. So when the third person saw his hand, he's like, okay, I fold. All right, I've seen that all the time, right?
Yeah.
So now both players are all in. They run the flop, jack, jack, X.
Flops quads the one time he exposes his hand prematurely.
Flops quads, and oh, I'm sorry, the guy didn't fold, he called. At that point, he folded as soon as the flop came, because you can't beat quads, right?
Right.
So the guy lost a tremendous amount of, potentially lost a tremendous amount of value by exposing his hand. And then, of course, getting quads at the last, the worst possible time to get it.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows whether he got another dollar out of it. I mean, with a paired board and stuff. But yeah, he was pretty beaten up by it, and he probably should have been. So, you know, reminder to follow the action.
Yeah. Flopped quads on an exposed hand is pretty funny. remember when we had Chris Moneymaker on the show?
No, I don't. When was
that? Do you remember that? It was a little while ago. You know, the world champion from 2000, was it 3, I guess?
Yes.
You remember that? Yeah. Yeah, we had him on the show. And I you know, a lot of times I like to come up with questions that, you know, they make you think. They make you go, hmm. And one of the questions I asked him was, you know, hey, do you ever wish, after all the crap that you went through, do you ever wish that maybe that Sammy Farhawk called your bluff and then basically just beat your butt and took the title and then you could have just gone back into obscurity and had a bunch of money and continue to play the way you wanted to play? And he's like, hell no.
Yep.
I loved winning the title. But really, I thought, you know, what if? What if? Well, you know, one of our listeners actually wrote in and thought it was kind of interesting to think, his name was Gene, and he said, you know, what does the NEF Nation think that poker would have been like had Sammy Farhawk called then and then won? You know, what would be going on right now? Would it have just been, another pro wins the World Series, or would we be where we are today? And it's a very good question. So he's wondering, you know, what do they think it would actually be like now? What would poker be like? That might be a fun segment. Have somebody
write
in. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure Michael J. Fox's dad would become a successful children's book author and not be beat up by his boss.
What?
You know, in Back to the Future, when you go out and you change the world, right?
Oh, man, you're reaching, buddy.
A little too old school there for you?
Oh, that was pretty far back.
Yeah, okay. Well, it was just back in the news lately, so I thought they'd get shot there. I think it's a rule probing question, and Gene had some ideas too, which I didn't put in the show notes. But I mean, obviously, the obvious thing is you wouldn't have got anywhere near the mainstream coverage over this, right?
Mm.
Remember, we've been reporters our whole lives, and we know that a lot of them are pretty easy marks.
Yeah.
And when they hear somebody named Moneymaker wins a lot of money, ooh, that's a story. Where if it's Sammy Farhawk wins, it's not a story. Right? Or a grizzled pro that's been in the game for years wins, that's not quite a story. But an accountant who won a $40 satellite and now wins $200.7, that's a huge story, right?
Yeah.
It still would have had an effect, but I think it would be... I think it was a monumental effect what happened.
Sure. Well,
they won, and it wouldn't have been had it gone the other way.
There are a couple of things that people forget, though, is that, you know, the main event field was huge that year. It was in the 800s.
Yeah.
And you know, before that, it was much smaller than that. And people forget that, you know, who was the guy from Brooklyn that won it all, the amateur...
Marconi.
Yeah, Marconi. So, you know, he was an amateur and he won it all, and it did increase. Yeah, the field increased like fourfold or whatever. I think it was like 200 or 300.
Yeah, but that had more to do with online, didn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But I think it was growing. I mean, if it grew 50% from that year to his year, and then if it grew 50% again, it would have been 1,600, 1,700 in the next year. So it could have still taken off because it was growing. Obviously, it was getting popularity because of online. And people like to say that the World Poker Tour's whole cam and online were the main catalyst as well. So, yeah, it wouldn't be where we are today, but it would be interesting to see where everything goes. Also, too, I almost knocked over Sammy Farhawk and Bellagio on this trip that we just had by accident. And he was in the... I was in the lobby or something near the hotel, and I was looking around for... I think at the time I was looking for the poker room because I wasn't sure where I was. I was kind of disoriented, and I wasn't really looking where I was going. I turn around, and boom, there's Sammy Farah. And he's a little guy. He's not that big. I didn't realize how small he was because every time I've seen him, he's always been at a table, either on TV or even in person. And he's a little shorter than me. And I almost knocked him over. And if I had remembered this question, I might have asked him, hey, where do you think poker would have been had you won or called the bluff, you know? But
I wonder what he would say. That'd be a ballsy question to ask him, I think.
But, yeah. I missed that opportunity.
Like, hey, let me cut your arm and throw some salt in it there, Sammy.
I still would have asked him.
Do it for my enjoyment of my show. Dance for me, Sammy.
10 World Series later, I think you think he's over it by now.
I don't know. Because, you know, for the rest of his life, until he wins, he's going to be asked this question, right?
Yeah.
About the bluff of the century, and a couple of interviews I've seen, he has been very short about it.
Yeah.
You know, hey, wasn't a very good play, you know, but I made the best, you know, so.
Yeah. I remember it being a, when I watch that hand over and over again, I always think to myself, I fold there too. How do you not fold there? I mean, you had top pair at the flop, but by the end, so many hands beat him, you have to let it go. You don't know how the amateur plays, you have to let it go. So, I don't, you know, he's not like he's Bill Buckner and the ball's going through his legs. I mean, he had to fold there.
Yeah, you know? I know, but it's the same thing. I mean, Buckner forever is going to be asked about that, and Barthol forever is going to be asked about this until he does something bigger. And it's hard to top finishing second in the main event.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like he had quads.
Not like he exposed his hand and had quads and folded them.
All right, well, our hotline was busy while we were gone, and folks, you can call it at 813-448-1120. You call us, we give you something great, and an old friend, Big Guru, calls in this week to tell us about something in his local room.
Hello, this is Big Guru calling from the Crown Royal Poker Room at Dover Downs. I just witnessed the drawing for the Antioch Poker Cruise. Unfortunately, I didn't win. I only had one ticket. Lady two tables up won. I asked her if she wanted to sell it to me. She said no. She's going on the cruise. So I give you a report. Keep up the good work.
Oh, well, at least we know that they're interested in actually winning the cruise up there and taking them, and Big Guru is going to have to try again later on. But that's good, though, right? They're giving them away, and people are wanting them.
People are wanting them. Kind of like that. Building the excitement. That's what it's all about. But yeah, we'd love to have Big Guru back on. He was a blast on he was on the cruise that you weren't on, right?
No, I played with him.
He's been on one that you were, right?
Yeah, I played with him. Yeah, he was on one of our cruises. He was on the Monarch one, I think, Port Canaveral.
Yeah. And then he came on the New Orleans one with us.
Yeah.
But yeah, great guy. Good to have on the cruise. And hoping to see a lot of those regulars on this Baltimore cruise, because I think it's a little more convenient for them to get to. So.
Yeah, that's really close to him.
But definitely get out to Dover Downs and all the other places that we're doing giveaways, and we'll tell you all those here a little later in the show. But Big Guru, it's been a while since you called in, so you now qualify for some lovely, valuable swag, like a download of the Chinese 13 Card Poker app for Apple products from Smapsoft. Folks out there, you don't have to win to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes Store.
Riley Crawford, coolest name in the Antiup Nation.
You know, Riley, he's always going to get on the show just because of that name.
That's right.
You know?
And he's from, where is he from, Scott? You remember?
Rileyville somewhere. No, I don't know. I believe it's Colorado, but it could
Colorado.
Be.
That's what I thought it was, too. I always seem to ask about the guys from Colorado for some reason.
I could be wrong, though.
He writes in, he says, I think I have a pretty good handle on PLO8 and what a good starting hand is preflop. But he wants to know what the right percentage of hands to play preflop are. I think you probably answer this one a lot easier than I will, so that's why I'm reading this. So I'm generally a winner during these PLO8 sessions, but I'm playing anywhere between 35% and 45% of the hands. He says, is this too many? I know you might say if you're winning, you're winning, but maybe by being too loose, I'm leaving chips on the table. Also, isn't there a maxim in poker that the more cards you are dealt, generally the tighter you should be?
Well, yeah, I wrote back to Riley on this, and a couple things. One, there are greater poker minds out there than mine that can answer this, because obviously there is some statistical evidence on how many hands you should play, and I don't know that. But from an anecdotal standpoint, what I told Riley is, I think, personally, that this is a bad statistic to base your play on. I'm not really concerned about how many hands I'm playing. I'm concerned about how many chips I'm winning. And if I'm a game where I'm winning, then it doesn't matter whether I'm playing too many or too few hands. I mean, I know, I guess what he's getting at is, am I leaving value there? Should I be winning more? But I don't know. I think it's a weird statistic. I think there are probably better statistics out there that govern your play. Am I wrong?
Well, what I'm wondering is the game that he's playing in. Is this your regular home game that you're playing all the time? Or is this you're randomly sitting into a PLO8 game at the casino? Or are you playing online in one of these sites that are still spreading poker in our area? And that's the question I have to have answered before I can answer that one. Because really, if it's just an everyday PLO8 game that he's sitting down at and he's playing 45% of his hands, he's playing too many hands. I mean, I think every person that has written every book in poker will tell you that that's just way too much of a percentage of hands to be playing. And like he said, the more cards you get, the tighter you should be, and you definitely shouldn't be playing 45% of your hands and hold them. So if you're getting four cards, you should be playing tighter than that, which means fewer hands.
But here's the thing. If you can, and we'd have to get Gundam on the show, Darwin, help us, to break this down, but you know, if you are light years ahead in post-flop play from your opponents, wouldn't you then be? Wouldn't it be advantageous at that point to play a lot more hands than not?
Sure, that's what I'm saying. Though I don't know if he is light years ahead. If he's sitting at any, doesn't know who his competition is when he sits down, then he's playing too many hands. That's the thing.
Right. Anyway, I guess that's my point. Is that statistic by itself is almost meaningless, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I said I need to know the answer to that. If he's playing his home game every week and he knows he's better than all of his friends and he can outplay him post-flop, then there's no, that statistic doesn't mean anything because he knows when he needs to play because he's going to outplay them half the time. But if he's sitting down on a random table and doesn't know that the PLO8 bracelet winner is sitting next to him and then the PLO bracelet runner-up is sitting next to him on the other side, you know what I mean? Then he's probably getting involved in too many hands at that point. But if he, as long as he's, every time he's doing it, he's winning, then he clearly is gauging his opponents properly and playing the right amount of hands. And, you know, it just depends on his competition, I think, and what the game actually is.
Right, and I think the competition is the real key point here. I mean, you know, when we did our Omaha Age show, I remember Gambit laughing at me. He's like, man, if we played the way Scott did, we would never play a hand. You know, when I listened to starting hand requirements. But, you know, when I'm in a game with pretty terrible Omaha 8 players, I loosen up considerably. I'll play those double paired hands that are double suited or something that I would throw away against better players because I know that I'm going to get called down on really weak hands. So you have to adjust how you play, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm going to play looser in a game when other people are playing looser because I know, it, particularly in PLO8, the margin of difference between good players and bad players is so much wider than it is in the limit hold'em. So, you know, you get people, if you're in a game where you know people are going to call you down with the third nuts, you're going to smoke them all night, you know. And the more hands you can play and get out cheaply, the more hands you're going to win.
And PLO8, man, that is just a terrible game. I'm sure Gambit is saying that right now, too. He's like, it's just a bastardized game. It shouldn't even exist. It should be 08 or PLO, not PLO8. It's just a bad, bad game.
But his final question, is there a maximum poker that the more cards you're dealt, generally the tighter it should be? I think I'm just correct.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, people get excited when they come new to Omaha for the first time. Oh my gosh, I got all these combinations! I got 100 hands here. I got to play it. How can you fold? Well, you have to fold. That's why, because everybody's playing those. But that gets back to my point. If you got those kind of players playing in your game, it can be profitable to loosen up and play some sub premium hands. If they're playing even less premium hands.
A lot of times when I'm playing this type of game, too, I'm always playing it shorthanded, too. I'm never really playing it in a casino willingly, sitting down at the table to play PLO8. It's always in the home game when we have five players, or, you know, with my family who wants to play a fun game or something like that. They want to try something different or whatever. So I'm always playing it where there's only 8 cards out, you know, or there's only 20 cards out instead of, you know, 36 or whatever, you know. And so I think that I'm probably a little too loose in that game when I play it, too, because, you know, we're just never at a full ring table when I'm playing it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's...
Well, again, it comes down to, you know, having the second nuts versus the fourth nuts kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, it's... I don't play all those... While I play more hands pre-flop, I don't play necessarily more hands to the river. You know, I'm just playing based on the board, knowing that people are going to be a little more reckless than they should be.
Right.
Then you're picking up an edge by playing loose. Whereas if I'm playing in the World Series, no. Not playing crazy, because Mike Matusow is going to kick my ass.
Yep, that's right.
All right, Riley, obviously you know you're a frequent contributor, so we have no swag for you today. But everybody else, email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we'll send you something wonderful like a deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Antiup. Pick up your own decks in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com.
The Call to Four this week, we'll be handling it ourselves because it happened while we were in Vegas, and it was pretty interesting. A lot of people probably already know about this. There was this incredibly controversial hand during the 50K Poker Players Championship. And it came during, what, it was Omaha, right? Scott, it was
Omaha. It was during Palo Omaha.
Yeah, Palo. So, we'll post a link to it in the recap because there is, like, a video and a write-up of basically how the hand broke down. And I have to admit, I tried reading the write-up of it three different occasions. And couldn't get through it. It was just It was so convoluted and so long,
too detailed. But I will say, Poker News did a good job in following up with the video they did with that had a interview with two or three players involved, another player at the table, and then the floor that made the final decision, which really got into a lot more detail than we'll be able to get into on the show. So definitely follow Chris's link on the forum and watch it and join in the discussion about it.
I guess I'll read it. During the Pot Limit Omaha round, Sean Deeb, our good friend who still owes me $50, he bet pot pre-flop, but he had less than a pot-sized bet in his stack. Nikolai Yakovenko then said all in, but he couldn't go all in based on the maximum raise allowed. Abe Mosseri, who's actually from Florida, then tanked before calling and flipping his cards up. Neither Nikolai nor Abe were all in, but the dealer ran out the board, giving Deeb the best hand for the main pot and Abe the second best hand for the side pot. The initial floor ruling was that the turn and river would need to be returned to the deck, shuffled, and the rest of the hand played out in order. However, Deeb asked for a higher ruling, and the subsequent ruling was that since there was substantial action, the board will remain intact, and the two remaining players accepted that both were all in. Deeb tripled up, Abe doubled up, and Nikolai was left with 15,000 chips. That's just a bad ruling, I think, right?
I think the final ruling was better than the first ruling, but right. What was interesting is at the time when we were out there, people were talking about, and if you read the recap from Poker News, the players were livid about this. Everybody was. Sean Deeb was upset. Nikolai was upset. Abe was upset. And you go back and look at the video now, and I think there's, upon reflection, there's a little bit more contriteness on all the players that this was a difficult decision, and it could be ruled a number of different ways. In fact, actually, it was ruled two different ways here.
Right.
And they actually accepted, at least Nikolai and Sean in the video, accepted that either way would have been acceptable to them in hindsight. Obviously, when you're Sean Deeb sitting there and you're looking at a board and your tournament's on the line and a $50,000 buy-in tournament and you have the hand won and tripled up, you don't want those cards returned to the deck and risk losing, particularly because he had a sub-premium hand. He was just playing the odds of having all that dead money in there. And he got lucky, or Barron's caught up to him, whatever you want to say. But when I initially heard this, I thought the returning the cards to the deck seemed like an atrocious decision. I guess upon reflection, I understand why, that you have no one set all in. I don't really know why the dealer ran the cards out without that, although it sounds like it was completely confusing. In fact, actually, in the Poker News story, they said they had to borrow some guy's iPad to figure out what the raises were. That's how complicated it was. And then in the video, too, I mean, there was some love from the players given to the dealer for, trying to manage the situation as best he could. But, again, it's one of these unfortunate things. You hate to see it happen in a $50,000 tournament, and particularly Pot Limit, where things are so complicated. And you can't back up the action. I mean, we can go back and stop the dealer from dealing out the cards and getting the pot right, then this wouldn't be a problem. But once that happens, you got to do what's right. So, I mean, in the end, who got screwed here, I think, was Nikolai. I mean, he said he never set all in, and then he was forced to commit 135,000 chips that he never committed to the hand. Now, if you look at the story, too, I mean, there wasn't a video of this actual debate going on.
Right.
But I wonder at what point he said, whoa, hey, what are you doing? I'm not all in yet. Was it after the cards came out and he saw that he lost? Or was he trying to say it and the dealer was just quickly running the board out? That to me, that's the kind of the question. And I don't think that came up in any of the stories or the videos that I've seen.
Yeah, it sounds like he said all in because, I mean, I've heard on more than one account that he said all in and then he couldn't go all in.
Right.
But the dealer didn't realize he couldn't go all in, so the dealer let the cards run, thinking that he was all in, but he wasn't all in, and so you have to let the action has to stop there because the cards are exposed both by the players and by the board. So I think the final ruling was really the right ruling. Returning any cards to the deck after that, the hands have been exposed, the action is complete, and you don't make him go all in because he couldn't go all in. You can't have extra bets being thrown in when it's legally not permissible because it was a pot limit game. So I think it was right in the end. And I thought it was really funny too, is it does not mention here, but because this hand had taken like literally 45 minutes to get through, that the other table was actually coming over and watching it, and they weren't getting any hands in. And then when they finally got they had to redo a redraw and bring Ivy over to that table, everyone's like, no, Ivy's got to sit out for like 20 minutes so we could play at that level, because they got to play at that level for 20 minutes while we sat here and tried to hash out this hand. And we're like, that is not going to happen. You're not going to have Ivy sit out, you know, just so you guys could play a few hands and have Ivy stand in there, you know. Oh, man, that's just, it was hilarious. And I think that the bigger the buy-ins and the more professional the players are, the more difficult it is. These guys are just, some of these guys are just, you know, crotchety old guys, and some are, they're so serious, it's so much money, you know, they're so on edge, and, man, I just hate to be a dealer in that game.
Yeah, well, you know, the clock was an interesting part of this, and, you know, again, if you watch the video, you see that in the end, that's what Chandi was most upset about. He's like, you know, hey, once this got contentious, someone should come over and pause the clock, because it ended up taking, he said, his estimation was that from beginning to end, this whole thing took 45 minutes, you know, which is a significant part of a level. I mean, most of our local tournaments, that would be two levels.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe some of our manager-type people that are listening to the show can send us what they think about stopping the clock for the tournament for a controversial hand. I mean, I just can't imagine that you're going to start stopping the clock every time the floor is called over. But how do you know when you're called over whether it's a situation that's going to take this long and that you do need to stop the clock until after you got to that point, you know? So I really wonder whether that anything could have been done there. And then, of course, you know, they're trying to, you know, I guess what they're trying to say is, you know, hey, sorry, it took 45 minutes, but just let us, because they were going on a break, I think. So, you know, like, just let us play for 20 minutes by ourselves. And I just don't think he could do that.
It does raise a lot of questions, though, because that whole interval thing. Because let's imagine now the worst case scenario, and you're two from the bubble. So they weren't playing hand for hand yet, but you're forcing the other table to keep playing for 45 minutes by themselves, and two guys get knocked out when the other table got to sit around and do nothing for 45 minutes and back into the money. Or vice versa. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, these other guys got to play for 45 minutes with terrible players and got more hands in while you're sitting there waiting and you can't get hands in. Meanwhile, the blinds are going up. You know, it's just, there are so many things that happen. But if you're playing in a tournament that's like 3,000 people, you can't stop a 3,000-player tournament because something's going wrong at one table.
Right.
These tournaments got to end, you know. And luckily, these kind of things don't happen all the time, because if they did, I think the sport would die. I mean, I really do. I think tournament poker would die if you had to stop the tournament clock and have 45-minute rulings every, you know, third tournament or something. It literally would kill the sport.
Well, you know, the other interesting thing, too, is, and this has come up on our call the floor before, too, is, you know, it was almost like Sean Deeb got an appeal here. You know, hey, I don't like that ruling. Give me somebody more important than you.
Yeah.
And they brought somebody over, and they would have brought Jack Eppel over, but he had left for the day, so they got the highest-ranking person there to come over. I mean, now, granted, it's a 50K event, and maybe they bend the rules a little bit for that, where they wouldn't do it in your normal $60 tournament, but it does open up that can of worms, right, where we talked about, hey, if you don't like the ruling, then just keep asking for another one until you get the one you want, and meanwhile, the clock is ticking, and, you know, obviously I feel bad for Nikolai here, because he committed chips that he wasn't, but really the big losers in his hand were the other, you know, six people at this table that weren't getting any play for 45 minutes while these other three people were arguing, you know.
Yep.
Very interesting hand. Very interesting hand. So, but we do have a couple of listeners submitted. Call the floors out to our great friend Jody Russell. So hopefully he'll get his answers back here soon, and we will resume with regular call to floors soon. But if you have any other problems out there, email them to us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we'll have Jody answer them.
And this next one is kind of shocking to me because I really thought more people would try to solve this. And I think maybe a riddle might have been a little strong for what this was, but feedback this week. I remember David Bloomberg had sent in that scenario that happened to him at a World Series of Poker Circuit satellite a little while ago. And then when it actually happened to him, the dealer said to him, you know, and this dealer apparently is one of those, he goes with the circuit, so he's been all over the country, deals all the time. And he said that this probably only happens once every few years or so. Here's what happened. This is the scenario. Our friend David here was under the gun, and he pushed all in. He was called by one player. He lost the hand, yet he had the exact same chip stack when everything was all said and done. And he wanted to know, how did that happen? And a few people on the forum chimed in on it and got the answer right. One or two didn't. When he sent it to us, I think I got it back to him pretty quickly. But even so, I'm just surprised that many people didn't really say, oh my God, this is wild. It took me a while to figure it out or whatever, and write in. But really, we only had a few write-ins and a few on the forum. I was pretty shocked by that.
Yeah, maybe just because it turned out to be easier than it should be. I mean, I didn't really get a chance to figure it out on my own because you had already emailed Dave back, so it kind of ruined it for me. maybe it was, in the end, the answer is fairly straightforward. It's just one of those quirks, I think. So, and we don't know what the blinds are here, but one of our letter writers, you know, created blinds for us here so we can understand. Blinds are 100, 200. Our hero pushes in for 2,000. Called by an all-in player who has only 100 left. The blinds fold, and so that guy wins, and he has 400, but then you pick up the dead blind money, and you're even with what you bet.
Right, exactly.
Kind of cool, though.
Yeah, I mean, there were other scenarios that people were trying to come up with. It's kind of like Jeopardy when it was on Cheers, and they named three actors, and Cliff's like, who are three people who are not in my kitchen, who are never in my kitchen? And it's like, that's the right answer, because those are the people who are never in his kitchen. But, you know, Alex Trebek is like, you know, you made me rethink it, that there's not always just one answer for each question. And same here. I mean, yeah, there could have been sort of a missed deal, two six of diamonds came on the flop, and you started over. But the fact that he says he lost the hand,
Right.
Means that it had to have played out, so that couldn't have really happened. But we had a lot of fun with it, and yeah, that's the answer to our, quote, riddle of the week.
All right, a little housekeeping here. Reminder that we're in the middle of our annual fan survey. You have less than a month left to participate. Visit antiupmagazine.com/survey. Have your voice heard and be entered for thousands of dollars of great prizes, including the grand prize of lunch and a one-hour lesson from Sammy Farha. Or the guy that beat him, Chris Moneymaker.
Yeah.
So fill that out. We were closing that off on August 1st.
We also looking for some ambassadors again. Reno, Deadwood, and Louisiana now. If anyone is in those areas and they'd like to try to contribute to the magazine once a month, we are open for that. Apply at antiupmagazine.com/ambassadors.
And then don't forget our 2012 Poker Cruise schedule at antiupmagazine.com/cruise. Two more great cruises. August 27th out of Port Canaveral. Giveaways are going on at Palm Beach Kennel Club, Seminole Hard Rock Hollywood, Tampa Bay Downs, Ebro Greyhound Park, and Blue Shark Optics. And November 10th out of Baltimore, giveaways, as Big Guru mentioned, at Dover Downs. And we're working on the 2013 schedule as well, too, so stay tuned for that. But right now we got two great cruises coming up the rest of the year, so get on board.
Let's check in with our Antiup News Desk.
All right, Full Tilt CEO Ray Vitar returned to the United States on Monday and was arrested when he landed in New York. Vitar said he returned as a necessary step in completing PokerStars' purchase of the site and returning money to players. Vitar, who is remains committed to his innocence, faces 9 counts of conspiracy and fraud and faces 145 years in prison if convicted on all of them.
Yeah, you know, and the thing about this is that we're like, you know, he says that it's a necessary step in completing the STARS purchase, but neither STARS nor anyone else's, you know, DOJ or whatever, has actually said that. So
right, yeah.
he feels that way, and, you know, we're not saying that's what's going to happen or whatever.
I got to think.
but you just never know.
It's tough to trust this guy based on what we know, but I would say, hey, if I'm going to go to the U.S. where I know I'm going to get arrested, there better be a good reason for it.
That's right.
Otherwise, I'll just hang out in Ireland where he has been for the last, you know, year and a half.
And, you know, he's going to be like, what, like 190 if he gets out of prison if he's convicted. So at least then he'll know that they did the right thing. Okay, Delaware Governor Jack Markell has signed a law authorizing online gaming in his state. Lawmakers expect licensing and testing to take about 6 months, with the possibility that Delaware residents will be playing online by January. I had a chance to talk to Rich Muni from the PPA. I talked to him for about 25 minutes or so at the World Series, just chatting with him. And I asked him if you know, what do you think about the online situation in Delaware? Because it's such a small state, you know. And he's like, well, I got to tell you, if it was just poker, it might be tough. He said, but it's online gaming. And he said, with all gaming open, he said, I could literally run a sports book with like 15 guys on my site and never have to worry about another dime as long as I live. So basically he was saying, as long as there's all gaming involved, that Delaware should have a really good run at this, not only working but thriving. So pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't have the player liquidity problems when you're not dealing with poker.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
For a blackjack game or a slot machine, all you need is one person.
Yeah.
Poker, you need more. So that's the big difference.
Very good.
All right, and then finally, Antonio Esfandiari won the unprecedented $1 million buy-in, big one for one drop World Series of Poker event, and a record top prize of more than $18 million. And also, Andy at PokerCast fan favorite Lee Childs picked up a second cash of the series, finishing 16th in a no-limit hold'em event. And today, he's pretty close to winning the Venetian deep stack.
Yeah, he's going deep in the Venetian. Up and down, watching him on Twitter is, oh man, it's like a ride. You know, you live and die by what he's going to tweet, you know. It's like, oh, I lost a big one before dinner. Oh, I'm back, you know, or whatever. And it just drives you crazy. But, nice job, Lee. And I actually watched pretty much all of this Fondiari final table. I watched it on TV, the live stuff. And it was nice to see the live tournament coverage again. And I thought they did a good job with it. I felt bad for Helmuth. He literally, they kept track of an interesting stat this year, which I don't think they've ever done before, and it was premium hands. The percentage of premium hands that they got in relation to all their hands, not in relation to others. So, Esfandiari, in most of the, while they're keeping the stat, he was getting 20% of his hands were premium hands, and premium hands were indicated as a pair of nines or better, and then ace-king or ace-queen.
Okay.
And so if you had ace-king, ace-queen, or nines or better, it was considered a premium hand. And 20% of Esfandiari's hands were premium hands. Now, Helmuth played the entire, I guess it was probably a good 5 or 6 hours at that final table, never saw one premium hand, and still made it to like fourth place or whatever. I mean, it was just a testament to his patience. And he never blew up. He never was an idiot, you know, as they like to call him, and not the brat. I mean, he just was quiet, really couldn't do anything. And then he finally gets the Cosenza, ace-10, and all he has is the blinds behind him, goes all in, and of course Sam Trickett wakes up with ace-queen and calls his all-in on the last hand. And he flops two pair, he flops aces up, aces and tens, and then Trickett ends up turning like the world on the turn and then makes a Broadway, I think, on the river to knock him out. So really, he never saw a premium hand the entire time he was there, and still finished in the top four, and that was really incredible.
Absolutely, that is amazing.
Yeah, and it was a good final table, and really from beginning to end, you knew it was going to be either Esfandiari or Trickett, but you felt like it was going to be Esfandiari just the way he was playing. He was just playing the big stack so beautifully, and really his reads were really really good, and he can get people to lay hands down, and it was a fun final table.
Yeah, and a great event. You know,
yeah,
we'll see whether
really
they
goes.
Can keep continuing in the future. I mean, I would imagine once you get one down, they prove they can do it. It's only going to get bigger and better. So.
Yeah, and I think I heard this. I'm not sure if it's correct or not, but I think I heard them say they're going to try to do it every other year because it's just so hard to get that kind of money
Might again.
Every
yeah.
year. But I don't quote me on that. I think I heard somebody say that about Guy. But pretty cool. All right, hey, we get to complete an O'Malley's move today, right?
Absolutely.
Pretty exciting stuff. Let's hear part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at an eight-handed 1-2 PLO8 game. The table is fairly passive pre-flop, but can get aggressive after the flop. The blinds post, the under-the-gun calls, under-the-gun plus one and two fold, the MP calls, and we're in the cutoff with the ace of spades, king of diamonds, eight of clubs, three of spades. We have two suited wheel cards, as well as two Broadway cards, but we don't like the dangling offsuit eight. We're just going to call the big blind. The under the gun has roughly 640 to our 400, but we've got the MP outchipped by about 140. Additionally, the under the gun is probably the best player at this table, besides us. He can be crafty and plays his hands very well post-flop. The small blind calls and the big blind checks. They each have about the same chip stack that we do. The pot is $10, and we see a flop of the king of hearts, four of spades, deuce of spades. We flopped the world here. We couldn't ask for a better situation. We've got top pair, a steel wheel, and nut flush draw, as well as position. The blinds check, and the under the gun wastes no time in putting in a bet of $10, the size of the pot. The MP calls, and we know we have to raise here. We've got a huge draw, and top, for what it's worth. But in 08, you've got to bet your draws when you have them. We make it $40 to go. Both blinds get out of the way, and the under the gun fiddles with his chips. At first, he counts out a raise, but then he just puts in a call. The MP calls as well. The pot is at 130, and the turn is the Jack of Hearts. As far as we're concerned, this is a brick. But this time, the under-the-gun checks, as does the MP. It looks like our raise on the flop has given us control of the hand. We decide to keep up the aggression, knowing full well we really have nothing so far except for one pair. We make it $75 to go. This time, the under the gun really appears to be calculating the pot and trying to get a read on us. We're screaming in our minds for him to fold, but after a long while of thinking about it, he makes the call. Finally, the MP folds. The pot is at 280, and the turn is the horrendous 10 of hearts. However, the under the gun once again checks to us. We have just $3 more than what's in the pot, while our opponent has over $500. What do we do?
All right, I'm going to go back to the turn and save that $75.
You know, I'm not trying to jump ahead here, but I'm the exact same thing. As soon as I heard that, I'm like, oh my God, I would never have done that. But all right, go ahead.
You know, I like raising my draw on the flop, but on the turn, I think it's time to exercise some pot control, take my free card. But, you know, we're not analyzing what we could have done. We're not doing the flex capacitor going back in the future.
Except with Sammy Farha.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, yeah. Two references there. I'm trying to beat it home today on the show. But as played, I don't have enough confidence here to fire the third bullet. You know, our opponent, the way he's been described, he sounds like he's wanted to raise once, maybe twice this hand. And you don't just do that on a draw out of position. I think you have to have something here. And the only thing we can beat here is a busted draw. It's hard for us to represent hearts, and I think that's key here. If we could represent hearts, then it's a different story, but I really don't think we can. And so all that considered, I think we got to wave the white flag here, hope that our read is off, and by some miracle our top pair is good, and if not, we lick our wounds and come back. There's another hand going to be dealt within a couple seconds.
Yeah, you know, I think that you're right with the word miracle there. I really don't think a pair of kings is going to be enough. So the question is your read. You know, is it strong enough that you think that even though this guy was pretty eager to get some money in early on, did he back in the Broadway or the heart flush? Because if he didn't and you think he could really get him to lay his hand down, then I think I'd bet about a half pot or so. But I just don't know if that's going to happen in this game with this amount of money on the table. If I feel like he's not going to fold, then I'm going to have to wish I did check that turn and then check the river. I really don't like that turn bet, to be honest. I mean, if you thought I was going to take the hand down or whatever, that's one thing. Or, you know, if it was a smaller amount and you're trying to build a pot, that's another. But really, pot control, I felt like was really important there. And that bet on that turn was just gratuitous. And
I mean, to that point, you got one bet to make between these two streets, I think.
Yeah.
And, of course, you don't know what the river's going to be. So, I mean, we're doing it in hindsight, but... You know, he made the bet on the turn, and I mean, I think that means you don't make the bet on the river, and you took your shot there and you lost. You're compounding the problem, I think, maybe by betting again here, whereas, you know, if you check the turn, then you've got that money you can bet here and make that that bet on the river. And if had you checked the turn and bet the river, then you could represent the hearts.
Right.
I think that's the difference here. I mean, when you fired on the flop with one heart, and then you fire again when the turn gets two hearts, it's just so hard to represent those. You know, unless you got some other combination, and I think that's what you need to represent here.
And that's true, and I think that's the beauty of the raise on the flop, is that you've gotten your pot control and your free card, and there's no reason to commit any money in the turn when you only have one pair. Let's try to improve to two pair, or to make our draws on the river. And hope that happens. And when it doesn't, then you've gotten away with just that $40 raise. And you know, but it depends. If you got a really good read on this guy in this field, you know, you might be able to steal this pot on the end. It's a dicey situation you're in. Okay, let's hear part two. See what happens.
Hello again. This is what is so frustrating about Omaha 8. We flopped the world, and we're in the perfect bluffing situation. But really, all we can beat is a busted low draw, which is exactly what we have. Additionally, we know he could be planning a big check raise. We took command on the flop and the turn, so to him, there's a reasonable chance that we're going to bet out again on the river. If he had played something like Ace-Deuce-Trey-X with a suited Ace of Hearts, we're in a lot of trouble. But there's only one way we can win this hand, and there's quite a bit in the pot. We decide to make a bluff disguised as a value bet. With 280 in the pot, we count out 125, less than half the pot. This leaves us enough behind to fold if he comes over the top, and we're hoping this savvy opponent will read this as a bet we really want him to call. The danger is, he might see this as a bet we carefully placed, hoping he'd fold. Our opponent agonizes over the decision for what seems like an eternity. Finally, he flips over two of his four cards, the four of hearts and the four of clubs. He flopped middle set. He looks at us for another few moments while we do our best impression of an ancient Greek statue. Finally, he turns the fours back over and throws his cards into the muck, and we breathe a subtle sigh of relief. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying sometimes the best feeling in poker is utter relief. I hope to see you on the felt.
All right, well, hey, I got to give O'Malley credit here. He found the right bet amount to win this pot. I think as an ongoing concern, though, I'm not sure that play is going to work against most opponents.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, the takeout here is we kind of took our shot on the turn and, you know, it made a good bet here, so I'll give him credit. But
yeah, I mean, I think we mentioned that the read really was key here, and I think O'Malley probably had it right on the nose. I think he felt like he can get the guy to lay the hand down, and he was channeling Stu Unger, you know, to fire that third bet like that. And, you know, all more power to him. I just don't know if I would have had the nads to do it.
I mean, again, it's a pretty risky thing. I mean, what, we bet 125 there to essentially win what was 280, you know. Yeah, it's just a tough thing. You got, like I said, I mean, he picked the right amount, so
yeah,
he got it right. But, you know, you bet too much there and you get raised and you cost yourself more. You bet too little and you get called, you cost yourself. So
Yeah, he found the right number. And that's the other thing, too, is, you know, what story is he selling there? That he had a set of kings the whole way? You know, and if he had a set of kings, would he have raised preflop with pair of kings? And if he wouldn't have, then okay, that's fine. That's fine. But now he's saying he's still not afraid of Broadway, and he's still not afraid of hearts, and he's still betting. You know, he must have backed into something there to do it. So he really had to get the right read on his players to get them to lay that hand down, because that story was kind of fishy.
Yeah, and it's far easier to believe that our opponent had got there on the end.
Yeah.
Because he was just calling us, calling, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's even tougher at that point to try to sell that you get a better thing than he has, you know.
It's pretty incredible.
But it worked out, so. Yeah.
Nice job.
Yay, O'Malley.
Yeah, nice job, O'Malley. Looking forward to listening to this, because I've had to listen to it all week. Now we get to hear it as a anecdotal fun thing, but it wasn't fun when I was there, so I can't wait to hear you spin this one.
We'll promise that we'll get to the poker here real quickly, but yes, as Chris said, this trip was defined, and for all the listeners that followed me on Facebook, they certainly know every detail of this. You know, the funny thing is, when we planned this trip, I was in Philadelphia for some fun with the wife, and was flying straight from there out there. You were flying from Tampa. And by the miracle of airline scheduling, we were able to land within 15 minutes of each other.
Yeah.
Even though we're coming from two drastically different states and flying 5 hours across country, right?
Yeah.
So I get there, I land a little bit before you, and I'm like, you know what, I'll wait for Chris here, meet him in the gate, and then we'll walk over. And then I'm like, you know what, Chris didn't check luggage. I did. I should go down there and save some time, get my luggage, and we'll just meet down there. It's not like, you know, we're joined at the embryonic cord or anything here, right? So I go down to get the bags, and there's no bag. There's no luggage for Scott Long on the carousel. And I'm like, oh, boy. And this has happened to me before in Vegas. You know, it's a big airport and stuff. And I'm like, all right, so I just got to go let them know, and then it'll probably come later on another flight, and they'll deliver it to my hotel. And that's exactly what they said. Hey, don't worry. We got six more flights today. I'm sure it's going to be on one of them. Here's a fill-up the little report. And where are you staying? I'm staying in Bali. All right, we'll deliver tonight. All right, great. Thanks. We are more than a week and a half later. I still have no luggage. They never did find it. And after we did finish the show here, I got to do a file a formal report and list everything and come up with receipts for everything I bought. Absolutely brutal. But yeah, I never got my luggage.
Unbelievable. And it was every morning, you know, he'd have to try to check in. And exponentially each day, as you can imagine, Scott got more and more frustrated. Even though it was more and more likely that his luggage would not be found, and we knew it wasn't going to be found with each passing day, Scott got more and more hopeful, or at least his tone was like, oh, man. And finally, at the end, he's like, sir, have you ever had your luggage lost? And I'm sure Scott was expecting no, but the guy was like, yeah.
He called my bluff.
He called your bluff. But Scott was just like, this is not how you're supposed to treat your customers, sir. You know, and I'm just like, oh, my God. Please find this guy's bag. Please find this guy's bag. Not only that, but also because you were wearing the same pair of pants for 5 days.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
the desert.
Don't need to get into too much detail on this, but listeners out there, listen. Here's the thing. Don't ever hope that this happens to you, because they are just inhumane on how you can go out and buy stuff. And so it was a pretty nasty trip in terms of the clothing situation.
Yeah, they gave you like $70 to start. I'm like, you can't even buy a pair of pants for 70
bucks.
$50. Yeah, and you had to like talk them into like a little more.
I had to beg for $100 so I could buy underwear, and then eventually begged him up to $300 so I could buy some new luggage, because I had, you know, I wasn't just in Vegas and going home. I was leaving from there to go to New Mexico and then Colorado. I mean, you got to have stuff to wear.
Yeah. Oh, man, absolutely brutal. And it's like, by the time you bought all the stuff for your contacts and all the just a regular, you know, health and beauty aid section, that stuff that you have to go grab, you spent pretty much all the money they allotted for you. And then it's like, oh, by the way, I don't have any pants or shirts. Hello. And, yeah, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And I know it's because they're hoping to God that they're going to find your clothes and your bag and get it to you so they don't have to lose any money. But really, after a day or two, they have to pony it up and say, hey, we screwed up. Whether you find your luggage or not, we got to own up to this and take care of our customer. And by the way, you're not some ordinary customer. I would venture to say you travel more than 95% of the population. And you use Southwest almost all the time. They should have recognized that right away and taken care of you, and it was a shame they didn't.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. But, you know, hey, there's worse things in the world, you know, fires and floods and things. So
yeah.
The fact that I just lost my bag, but is, you know, try to keep in perspective.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, you know, we're all about, I know the nation out there is always like, hey, Scott, what can we do to help you guys out? Well, here's the thing. I still don't have my bag, right? I'm hoping that when I fill out this report, Southwest will actually find it now for some reason. But I could use all the eyes and ears out there combing the country looking for my bag. Possible. So here's the thing. I'll put together a price package for anyone who wants to be Dog the Bounty Hunter here. And go out there and find my bag. You have to actually recover the bag. You know, you're not getting any credit for going and look for it. You know, Dog doesn't get any money if he doesn't find the guy, right?
That's right. So
you got to find the actual bag here. So I'm going to give you a quick listing of the contents here because I had to fill this out for Southwest Airlines, all right? So when you find it, it's a red Kenneth Cole bag with an Annie Up patch on it. It actually looks like it's sewn on there, which is kind of cool. Inside you will find 7 Annie Up shirts and 1 Annie Up hat. Essentially everything Annie Up I own is in there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You're going to find 3 Clearwater Thresher shirts, you know, because I was going to baseball games and stuff. A blue razor. A 6-pack of Pabst Blue Ribbon Tall Boys. There will be an autographed 8x10 glossy photo of Kate Winslet. And I don't like traveling anywhere without that, you know, because, you know, I have to put it on my nightstand. So, a copy of my Math for Dummies book. And a collection of Rosetta Stone CDs for the English language.
Oh, man.
So if you find the bag and it has all those contents in it, you know, email me at podcast@anniamagazine.com and send it to me, and I will send you a patch or something.
That's a prize package, huh? That's great. The Rosetta Stone, that alone's like $600, buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it does wonders for everybody but me. You know, I'm still not got that English language down. We're out there, obviously, we're out there to do business for the company. But it always makes sense for us to go out there during the World Series because it's, you know, obviously the biggest event in the world. And we spent a fair amount of time over the Rio, and I think this year was a little different than previous years. Am I wrong?
No, I mean, I think that it was interesting that they finally have it down. I think was it last year they introduced the deep stacks was last year that they started offering these deep stack tournaments. So it was still kind of a little crazy last year, but now they've had a year with it under their belts, and they've got this system down. And you know, the Rio is just so massive that when you're walking through, it feels like there's nobody there.
Yeah,
but they are there. It's just that they have it so organized. They have these tournaments in their own rooms, the Brasilia, the Amazon, and whatever, that the breaks are all synchronized so that, you know, one tournament will come out, but the other tournament isn't coming out, so they're not butting heads. And it's just so organized now. Really, it really is. You just feel like there's nobody there. And they are all there. It's just, you know, it's pretty interesting. It's a lot different than, you know, it's usually like Las Vegas Michael likes to call it organized chaos.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Really, it was pretty organized to me. I mean, it was remarkable that there weren't more people visible. And the only time you really saw them was if you went into the rooms to watch them play the tournaments or when they did come out on their break. Other than that, you felt like it was any other day at the Rio, you know? It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, from a spectator standpoint, I kind of like the old version where it was just pandemonium in there. Because you walked in, there was just people, you know, wall to wall, and people walking around and bumping heads and stuff. Now, obviously, when you get to the main event, maybe it's like that. We were out there for the undercard events, but from a player point of view, I got to think, and I didn't ask a lot of players this, but I got to think that this year's was probably the best in terms of organization.
Yeah.
You know, it did it lost a little of the excitement or the feeling there, but really, this is a series for the players, not for the spectators. So
that's right.
Doing a good job there. Attendance was down pretty markedly, too, and, you know, we did a lot of traveling around the city talking to other folks. There are all kinds of tournament series in Vegas this time of year, not just the World Series, and all of them are down. We heard anywhere from 20 to 25% at most of them. And, you know, we started asking some people why, and, you know, one that I didn't realize because I don't monitor currency exchange.
Right.
But they said that the euro exchange rate is down this year. And so that makes it harder for folks to travel from overseas. And, you know, as soon as I heard that, I'm like, you know what, you're right. You know, when you're just looking at the results coming in, last year was the international year of the World Series, right?
Yeah.
It seemed like every event was won by somebody that wasn't non-American. And this year, it seemed like very few that were non-Americans that are winning. And, you know, that isn't... One doesn't mean the other necessarily, but it does make it easier for Americans to win when there's fewer Europeans playing, right?
Right, certainly contributes to it. And you're right, the results have been dominated by Americans, and it's pretty remarkable. And you're right, I think at first we'd heard about the series, we didn't hear about the World Series, I mean, and we didn't hear about the other local series that are going on around it. But as we visited the properties, they were all telling us that, you know, and they also felt that it was the online money. You know, everyone forgets that, you know, April 15th last year, you know, was a big deal and stuff, but people still had the money. You know what I mean? They still had the money that they had from the year leading up to it that they had taken out and they could afford to go. Now it's a whole year basically of no online poker and no transactions and not getting any money out or having money sent to the cage for you or whatever. Now it's really hitting home that there's no online poker essentially, and these players just don't have the cash to pony up for these big events. So it's hitting everywhere.
Yeah, and the way to look at it, it's kind of like a trickle-up theory rather than trickle-down. I mean, you know, it's not that these big players aren't going out live and playing in big games. It's that the $5 sit-and-go player like me isn't playing online, losing to the $10 sit-and-go player.
Right.
Who then loses to the $25 sit-and-go player all the way up. And so there's a massive amount of money that's just missing from the poker economy. And we knew this all along, but it was just interesting to see that it actually took a year here to probably have that kind of effect. And you know, next year it could be even worse.
Yep. And in my case, it's the 1 cent, 2 cent losing to the two, four cent guy and whatever, taking a bigger step. But I mean, you know, you and I didn't really notice anything being down. We heard the numbers, you know, right, we read the numbers or whatever and saw it. And it was pretty remarkable. One of the best stories I felt, and it's funny how PLO8 is on our show like three times this week, but one of our passengers, multi-passengers for cruises, he's been on a few of them, won the PLO8 title while we were there, and we saw him in the hallway, and I was like, Steve, you gotta be kidding me, you won it, and like the first thing out of his mouth was like, when's the next cruise? And I'm like, dude, you just won like $250,000 and a bracelet, and you're talking about the cruise. That, I guess, testament of how much he really enjoys our cruises and playing poker with us, and he won a bracelet. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, well, what was even funnier about that, too, is, you know, we're out there at the series, but, you know, I wasn't really necessarily paying attention as much as I probably should be because I was doing other business and stuff, but we were having a good chat with our good friend Shortstack Seamus there in the media room and just catching up with him. And he was telling me that he was covering that event that day, so I was just kind of looking to see who was left. And as soon as I opened up, I'm like, oh, my gosh, Steven Lube!
Yeah.
He was on our cruise!
Yeah.
And so I ran over to kind of, I wanted to say hi to him before it started, and I missed it. But, you know, his wife was there and had one of those little Love You, Steven signs that she was holding up. And, you know, I'm sure he got the guys at the table loved seeing that, you know. But, no, it's a great story. I mean, this is a guy like us, you know. That doesn't play very high stakes and went out there, took a shot, and won. I mean, that's the dream of the World Series, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the funnier lines, he had a couple of funny quotes from the wrap-up, too. One of them was, you know, that it was a lot like work. You know what I mean? It was crazy how tough it was for him. And then the other thing was that what he likes to do, and I guess he plays in a home game in Georgia, that they play the Big O a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, they play for decent stakes. But he said, this is just Big O with one less card. And for those of you who don't know what Big O is, it's Omaha with five cards. And it's funny for him to make it that simple. You know, I mean, to me, it's not. It's so difficult. But once you master one game in that Omaha realm, you know, I guess it's pretty simple to convert to another one. And apparently, you know, he's the best one at it. PLO8 champion. Just unbelievable. Fantastic.
Yeah, and you know, it's probably good that I didn't get over to say to wish him luck before it, because we were the kiss of death when we were out there. You know, we got there during the PLO8, and they're like, hey, there's Tony Cousineau, you know, a great guy who's been on a cover, and I believe still has the record for the most cashes at the World Series without a bracelet.
Yeah,
correct?
That's true.
And so we walked over to say hi to him, and had a good chat, and then walked away, and we went our separate ways, and I walked back about a minute later, and he busted out.
Yeah, poof. Gone.
Totally
like
killed him. And then while I'm standing there, the guy was like, hey, Scott from Antioch, I listen to you all the time. And it was great. I just met a fan randomly there.
Yep. That is always cool. And I was wondering who you're talking to when it first happened, too. And then he walked away, so I didn't get to find out. But, you know, one of the things that we like to do is we like to walk around, you know, just to see if there's someone we should be talking to or interesting hands or whatever it is when we have a break from the meetings that we had. And believe me, we had a lot of meetings. And on the last day we were there, we're getting ready to fly out, But you were conducting, I think you might have had lunch or you're conducting one last, you know, thing or something for the magazine. So I said, I'm going to go look around at the ladies event and see, you know, how things are going. And I saw a hand that was just remarkable beyond belief. One woman had 6-7 of diamonds. Another woman had ace 10 of diamonds. Another woman had ace king offsuit. And another woman had pocket nines. The flop was 9 of diamonds, king of hearts, 8 of diamonds. So we have an open-ended straight flush draw. We have what the person thinks is the nut flush draw. We have top pair, top kicker in the ace king. And we have middle set in the pocket nines. And they got it all in, all of them. And the turn was a 7 of spades, which helped pretty much nobody, although it gave a open and a draw to the ace diamonds. And then the 5 of diamonds on the river. Straight flush takes it all. The ace of diamonds, 10 of diamonds gets knocked out. The ace king gets knocked out, and the 9-9. I mean, I think maybe one other person survived because they had more chips than the person who had 6-7 of diamonds. But, I mean, they got it all in on the flop. So that means, yeah, open and a straight flush draw, I guess you got to get it in. But the only thing I didn't know is I didn't know who got it all in first and who called.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was going to ask, because I think it would be – I'd be hard-pressed with that 6-7 to get it in.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it depends. If you're first and you're pushing, you got some confidence there. If you're at the end and everybody's in and there's so much dead money – I guess maybe I could see some reasons for that, but it'd be tough. That'd be tough to call off your chips with 6-7 on there when 3 other people in. You got to think somebody probably has better diamonds.
I was literally getting there as the last hand was calling the all-in of all the people, and then they dealt the turn and river. So I got to see the turn and river, and I got to see the river give this woman, and she didn't even realize it.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah, it was just so amazing to think it could happen. Yeah. Now, the other thing I was thinking is I would have loved to have a camera on the ace 10 diamond one.
Yeah.
And oh my God, there's the diamond I got. Oh, the one that doesn't help me. And the other thing that's amazing is you got 4 diamonds already taken care of there. Yeah. And then you still got 2 on the flop, and then the last one got there too. I mean, man, I'm not going to do the odds there, but I would feel more confident in this hand with the nines than I would with anything.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too, is the ace-king was literally drawing almost dead.
Yeah.
Had to come king-king or whatever, or king-ace or something for them to her to win. And, the 9-9, you had to think the 9-9 was just like, all right, well, I got to dodge some things here, but I got to be sitting pretty good with all those diamonds out. And sure enough, the 7 was like, all right, well, that hurts me a little bit, but, you know, I'm sure she's thinking, pair the board, and then 5 of diamonds. It was pretty sick hand. I mean, that's a straight flush, a nut flush, top pair, top kicker, and top set. That's just, or not top set, but a middle set. That's just a crazy, crazy hand.
You know, it would even be more hilarious as had the board paired on the turn.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of the dice would be like, woo, no problem. And then,
yeah, like a king. Like a king of clubs would have been really cool.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, absolutely.
3 kings of the ace, then, you know. But just a crazy, crazy hand. And I'm just randomly walking around. There's like, you know, 800 people in this event. And so you can imagine how many tables are there. And I just happened to walk by when this hand was going on. And, oh, it was absolutely crazy. That really is a sick hand. That's the kind of hand where you're just like, that can't happen live. You know, it can happen online, but it can't happen live. And it did. It happened right in front of me. Pretty crazy.
You know, the other frustrating thing, you know, I didn't have my luggage this entire trip, right?
Right.
Which is frustrating enough. But I'm addicted to soda. You know, I'm not one of these people who wakes up in the morning and has a cup of Joe. I have a bottle of Coke Zero. And one, I couldn't buy Coke Zero anywhere. Pepsi's taken over Vegas. I don't know how that happened. But every morning, you know, we went down the vending machine on our floor. It never took the dollar bills. So I didn't get a soda to start my day until the third day when I accumulated enough coins to actually afford the $2.50 for the soda. So I'm already on edge about the luggage and then not having my soda for the day. So I was pretty about as worse of a travel partner as possible as it was. And then, of course, we spent half our day over at the Rio, right? And I'm like, oh, my gosh, they got soda there. I'm grabbed it, went up there, and they're like, how was your day, sir? Oh, wonderful. That'll be $4.50. I'm like, my day was wonderful until you just charged me $4.50 for a 20-ounce soda and a Pepsi on top of it. Not even Coke Zero.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, here's the thing. I know this is an expensive event for the Caesars Entertainment to run, but, you know, at some point, it's just ridiculous. You know, and they do, I'll give them credit, you know, I'll complain in the past, but they give the media a $10 food voucher every day. So, I mean, they do things to help us out, and a water cooler. And this isn't really about the media. I'm talking about the players in general. But, I mean, come on, $4.50 for a soda? It's not a baseball game. This is, I think we're taking the whole sports analogy to a new level here with the World Series and thinking that we could charge $4.50 for a soda.
And it costs them about 8 cents for that soda.
Absolutely.
Yep.
But I paid it. I paid it because I need it. I'm a junkie.
Well, after that first soda that we both bought, that was it. I had water or I didn't drink.
Yeah.
And that's not a good tactic to take when you're in the desert, but I didn't care. It's either water or nothing. I was not drinking soda at the Rio. It was crazy expensive.
All right, well, we weren't there just for the World Series. We were driving around to visit some other rooms and friends that we had there and do some business. And we certainly didn't do that crazy 70 rooms in 5 days thing that we did last year, obviously.
Right.
We did far fewer rooms this year. But a couple of things that have changed since we were out there last year that I think we both found interesting. One of the things I was really looking forward to was getting back to the Palms this year. And we probably mentioned the show before, but if folks forgot, something really cool is going on there. Cantor Gaming, which is one of the big kahunas in the sports book business, is now running the Palms Poker Room as a vendor.
Yeah.
And, so they keep their, they're obviously paying some kind of fee to Palms to be able to do it, and then they keep the rake, which is not unheard of in the world. It's rather rare these days, but it's been done in the past. And so I want to see how that worked out. And we got there and found out that one of the great guys that was for our meetup there last year, Bobby Griffith, is the new manager. Just got hired that day, actually.
Yeah, it was weird.
And, he kind of told us how this thing works. And, I think it's kind of cool. We'll see how it works out. But, I mean, essentially, Cantor's idea is that they're going to build a poker room near the sports book, which is the business they do know how to run right now. And hopefully attract high-limit poker players that like to bet on sports. So I wouldn't call it a loss leader necessarily, but really they're trying to use poker as their advertisement for the sports betting where they'll make more of their money. And so they built the tables right there, a massive sports book. I mean, those screens were amazing, weren't they?
Yeah, it was remarkable. It's all one screen that's like 150 feet long, and then they can divide it up however they want to put the games on their based on importance or size or whatever the event is. And oh my god, it was so crystal clear, so bright. It was like you're at Times Square.
Yeah,
the lighting. Absolutely. it was really pretty clear, pretty remarkable.
And Bobby said they would never do this, but it was interesting to hear that they did it just to test it. But they actually put a NASCAR race up on the entire screen.
Entire
you could
screen.
Watch the car race across the that's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
but,
it's like you're actually there.
Yeah, and they built a nice little high limit area that's walled off. And so I give them credit. I want everybody to be successful, but I'll be interested to see what it means. I mean, if it does take off and they do very well, is this going to be a concept that they take to other places, in Nevada and get back to the old days where poker rooms were kind of vendors or yeah. vendored out.
Yeah.
So.
And that's their goal, was the main room, that big glassed-in single table high limit room, is to fill that with a big game every night, because that way if they have a really big game going there, you know what's going on there. They have big money. They have big money to gamble with, and that's basically what they're going to be doing, is betting on the events as well. So that's their goal, is to get a higher limit sort of player in there to be spending $20,000 or $30,000 on games and stuff too. So
yeah,
very exciting for them, and we'll see how it goes. We also went to the Venetian to see one of our favorite people in the industry, Kathy Raymond, who was elected to the Hall of Fame, the Women's Hall of Fame, while we were there. Pretty exciting stuff. We chatted with her, and we got to see their room. And they had the Venetian Deep Stack in the Palazzo again this time around. And so it made their room a little quieter, which is something we're not used to seeing.
Yeah, it's very different. Folks have been in the Venetian in the past. I mean, when you walk in, their main room is always bustling in the World Series. And then they have what seems like 100 tables right outside for the tournament, and it's kind of the pandemonium that we're talking about at the World Series that makes it very exciting.
Yeah.
And this year, obviously, they're working on the renovation, so the tournament was at the Plaza, which, you know, again, this is Vegas, so there's no... It's not next door. It's next door, but it's really not next door.
Yeah, right.
It's kind of like, you know, California and Nebraska, you know, in terms of walking. And so that meant the actual cash game room was, you know, I hate to say dead, because it wasn't dead, but, I mean, it just wasn't anywhere near... as hopping as it usually is because of that.
Yeah, it's usually just absolutely crazy. Every table's basically got a wait list, and every table is pretty much used, and you can't hear anything because it's just so loud with chip ruffling and people calling out and stuff, and it was just absolutely crazy. And this time we went there, and it was kind of like, and there's still a lot of tables going, but it's just nothing like it was when we were there last year. And that's all part of it, the fields being smaller and the tournament being split away. And I think they won't do that anymore once they have the renovations done.
I wouldn't think, yeah. Well, we did get to play a little bit. I didn't play a hand until the meetup 2 days later. I was just so busy and frustrated that I didn't. But I had a blast at our meetup. The MGM Grand took good care of us there. We played a mixed game. Karina Jett was there and hang out and played, and she's always fun to play with. Yeah. Poker Room manager Rob Moore actually sat down and played with us for a while. Great guy. He's doing some good stuff there. They're in the middle of renovating their room as well, too. So.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Good old Vegas. Everything's always changing. And we had a couple fans that showed up and played, and, you know... The great thing is, when we were talking to Karina about playing, she I went over and bought these two big boxes of placards of different games, and you just start digging through them like a kid on Christmas and throwing ones out. And we ended up with what I thought was a fairly interesting mix of games. We did play that Big O that we're talking about that really is becoming the new big game, I think.
Yeah, that was a big at the World Series, too. They had that like spread. Like five different or six
a lot
different
of tables.
Limits, yeah. A lot of tables had that spread there, and like you and I have talked about a lot before, it's in big in California, so it's working its way across, I think.
And you know, we've always talked about the big hockey game that Suncoast has out there on Monday. We didn't make out to play that, but we did play big hockey in this, which was a stud eight or better with a double qualifier. You had to have a two pair or better to win the high, plus you know an eight or lower hand to win the low, and if no one qualifies at the end. It's split between the remaining players, right?
Yeah, whoever's still in the hand at the end, if they checked it down or whatever it was, they split whatever's left. So it never happened. It never happened. We always had a scoop or we always had split. And that was an interesting game. And I think I won most of my money playing that game, believe it or not. And every other dime I lost was basically on the rest of this. We also played Deuce of Seven Triple Draw. And at least two players had to sit out. For that, I always hate having to sit out of hands.
Yeah, it's
drives you crazy. But we had so many people at the table that you had to have some sit out. Played Omaha 8, played regular Lemon Hold'em, played regular Pineapple, discarding before the flop instead of crazy when you discard after the flop, and a couple other games. So it was a really nice mix and games that we don't normally, even in our home game, we don't play Big O or Big Hoggy. And we don't play Pineapple either, so yeah. We play Crazy when we do play it. So
I think Big O and Big Hoggy are going to make an appearance here.
Yeah, I think so too.
Probably the next game, because they're too much fun not to play. But I got to say, Pineapple is no fun without the Crazy.
Yeah, it's like just like
gluten-free food. You know, don't take the gluten out. Leave the gluten in. That's what makes it good. Don't take the Crazy out of the Pineapple.
What do you mean no MSG Pineapple? You want to have MSG in there.
you know, it's you still have the frustration factor a little bit. But I think it, you build bigger pots and get more people interested with the Crazy where you can see the flop and then you have to, then you know, because your hand can go a couple different ways then.
Yeah.
You know, pre-flop, I mean, almost your decisions are almost made for you for the most part.
Yeah.
Other than, you know, do you want to go for the straight or for the flush? But I really thought that was, I thought that really neutered the game. I've never played it without the Crazy.
I have. I play without the Crazy. And you're right. It's a lot more fun when you have that extra chance to make a different hand when the flop comes. But the frustration is just that much more frustrating because, you know, you got Ace-King and you pair your
hand. Well, yeah, it's true, but it adds a little extra element, doesn't it? I mean, discarding pre-flop, I mean, your decision for the most part is made for you.
Yeah.
You know, on the flop, then you have some real tough decisions to make. And again, it doesn't really matter so much about that. To me, it's about building the pot, you know?
Yeah.
You know, if you got ace, 10, 7, and the ace and the 7 are suited, preflop and you got to throw one of them away, you may not play that hand because I mean you're not going to throw the 10 away and go for the flush necessarily unless there's a lot of people in the hand. But if you can keep those three cards and the flop comes, and then you could choose which way you're going, now you're in the hand and you're building a pot. That's what I thought was missing from it, really.
Yeah, but then it comes 10 high with two diamonds. Now what do you do?
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's what makes it fun.
Yeah, man.
But you're not going anywhere, I promise you.
That's right. So it was cool. I mean, it was nice. And I did. It's not that I went looking for the crazy pineapple placard or not, but I didn't really see it in my first run through all the placards, so I just grabbed it. Was happy to see it.
Well, I didn't complain either. I wanted to actually try it and see what I liked, and you know, so I tried it, and you know, I didn't like it. I didn't inhale.
like I mentioned, though, I think I did well in big hockey, but I did so poorly in the rest of them, so I had a losing session, and you know, I think that the reason is that I just have so much fun when we're playing again. Like, you and I are right next to each other, and we're in a meetup with fans and stuff, and I'm just wanting to play a lot of hands and have something to talk about and stuff, that I always end up pretty much losing in the meetups, and it's just so much it's so much fun that I don't really mind losing. You know, I know I have the rest of the week to try to get that money back playing at the other rooms with the tourists and stuff. So, the big hockey was the game that I really enjoyed the most. You know, speaking of actually going and playing somewhere else, after that, I was so frustrated that I lost, though, that I really want. It was late, too. We left the MGM after midnight,
yeah.
And I know that sounds funny when you hear, you know, you're in Vegas and midnight is late, but, you know, we have long days when we're there. We get up at 9 in the morning or whatever, and no one else does that in Vegas. So, for us, it was late, but I was like, you know what, I just want to get some hold'em in and just try to take a big stack off of somebody or something. So, first thing I did was I said, we're going back to our rooms, and we're staying at the Bally's, which has a poker room, and they had 1-2 no limit, and I was like, you know, I'll just sit down and play there for a little while. So I sit at the table, play about 15 minutes, and two guys got up and left, and the table had to break. So the floor comes over to us, and he says, look, I got two other tables here going. Take your pick. I got three seats at one, and I got one seat at another, or whatever you want to do. 2-2 it was. Take your pick, whichever one you want to pick, you can play at. So I go to one table, I'm about to sit down, and I noticed there were, for some reason, I just didn't like the way the stacks looked. It looked like I was going to be committing my whole stack for a raise. So let me go to the other table. It looked a lot more balanced and a lot smaller stack, so I could, you know, realize that these raises are going to be like $10 and $12, not $35 before the flop. So let me go to the other table. Three hands in, the table behind us hits a royal and splits like $1,100 bucks at the table. And I'm like, oh, my God. Now, they're saying, oh, if you had gone to that table, it wouldn't have been. No, that's not true, because those cards got dealt the way they got dealt. You know what I mean? I mean, yeah, you're probably right. It probably wouldn't have been a royal if I had sat down somehow, because I might have played a hand longer. I have no idea. But I can't believe I had a 50-50 shot at it, and they hit a royal. So,
well, I mean, let's be honest. You might have sat out because you missed your blind and not wanted to put the extra buck
in. That's true. That's true. I might have been too cheap
to
get
it. Phenomenally awesomer story.
probably wouldn't have told on the show. I probably kept it to myself because I've been so stupid. But anyway, I did win a lot of money back that night, so I felt pretty good about that. And I said, all right, I'm going to keep playing hold'em when I'm on this trip. And I go over to Caesars the next night. Is it the next night or the night after? And it's funny because you were going out with our friends Ramsey and Sanjay. And had dinner with them and stuff, and I said, I'm going to go back and go play, but I'm going to charge my phone first. So I go to my room and charge, and then you come up, and you fall asleep. And I'm like, oh, I guess Scott's not playing today. So I'm going to go over to Caesars and play over there, see what's going on over there. Because I went to Bellagio first, and the waiting list was just so long. I was like, I'm not going to wait this long. By the time I get on the table, I'm going to be exhausted when I go back to bed. So I went over to Caesars and sat right down on a 1-3 game. And I totally, totally, totally misplayed a hand that I have to share here. And interestingly enough, it involves a royal flush again. So I played pretty tight this trip, and I think I held pretty true to my axiom of ABC poker when I go to these things, because I'm playing so many bad players that I really don't have to get fancy to win money on these trips. And that's the most important thing to me, is I don't want to come home a loser on these trips anymore. I don't want to, because I resent it. So I want to win. So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to play tight and do what I got to do. And so I was about even or so, and didn't get any hands. And it was funny because I barely got any hands on the Valleys session, too. I just happened to pick up some hands at the right time and got guys to commit on hands that were second best to mine. But on this occasion, I was probably playing for a good 2 hours or so, and I was down like 40 or 50 bucks. Got it back to even, was up about $10 when the next hand came up. I still had not seen anything better than pocket sevens the whole trip, and that was about 3 sessions worth of playing. So I get ace, king of hearts, and two people limped, and it got to me. And so I made it like 13 or 14 to go, and folds around to this woman who, every time she played, she had the goods, from what I noticed. There's only one hand where I didn't get to see what she had, but it was, that's a hand that's coming up later on when we talk about it. So I'm not going to tell you the details. But anyway, I was led to believe she had the goods in that hand too, but just was finishing second or third best in the hand. So when she got involved in the hand with me, I was convinced that she's going to have big cards in her hand. So I'm like, all right, let's see what happens. I have ace, king of hearts. Flop comes king of clubs, queen of hearts, jack of hearts. Right? So I got top pair, top kicker, Broadway draw, and of course, oh, by the way, a royal flush draw if the ten of hearts were to peel off somehow. So she checks to me, and I bet $15. And she folds, like, almost instantly. And before the hands bitch to muck, I'm like, no. Take your cards back. Just call the bet, and then we'll check it down. I'll give you your money back. And she's like, huh? What are you talking about? I'm like, oh, my God. So, obviously, the dealer grabbed your cards, and I turned over my cards, and I'm like, I had a royal draw. And that was it. The whole table is like, dude, you're so stupid. You already had enough money in there to qualify. The royal flush is like 500 or 800 or something. You know, and my mindset was, I haven't had any hands this whole trip. I finally flop a good hand with a good draw, and I think she has big cards. I kind of want to protect my hand just because, what if she has like pocket eights and she turns an eight on, you know what I mean? You know, or something like that. So I'm thinking that she's not going to go anywhere for at least one street, and I just totally did not think it through. And I lost my chance at trying to make a royal and win a bonus hand. It was so embarrassing. I mean, would you have bet there, or do you check it?
Oh boy. You know, I had a similar hand. It wasn't as crazy as that, but a hand where I, you know, for some reason the tens were good to me on the rest of this trip, and I had a hand where I had ace ten, the devil's hand, and got frisky and raised pre-flop, and then I got like a gajillion call or something great. You know, I'm just being punished for playing this craptastic hand, right? And then I flopped two tens and bet into it, hoping that it would be seen as a continuation bet and someone would call or raise me, and then I could get more in. And of course, as soon as I fired, people were firing the cards in the muck faster than anywhere else. And I'm like, oh, man. But, you know, so you never know. I mean, you don't want to miss that bet. Particularly this lady, the way you're describing, sounds like she always has it.
So. Yeah.
You know, there's a reasonable shot that she had, and you're just building a pot. I mean, you can't play that game for the royal. I mean, obviously, had you hit it, it would have been a bigger payoff than winning the hand for stacks, I would think, probably. So, you know, maybe, it, you know, I mean, in hindsight, obviously, you wish you would have checked and hoped that she got there and or caught up or something, or not caught up, but got, you know what I mean. But
yeah. Well, the other thing I was thinking of, too, was that, And I didn't think about it until it was done, but they have the bad beat, and if she could have had, like, who knows, pocket tens, yeah. And then a ten of hearts comes, now she'd have a set, and I have the royal, and then a ten comes on the river, it's a bad beat, and we're splitting 50 grand or something. So yeah. I just, it's something to consider when you're playing, and I don't like to consider the bonuses and all that stuff. I just have to play my game and play properly and try to win some money, and I just, and this is why I bet out, too. A couple of hands before that, a few hands before that, actually, I saw a massive pot, and the kid, he was young, in like the three seat, had raised, and now this woman had re-raised, the same woman, had re-raised, and then another young player on her left called the re-raise, and I folded and had crap, as always, and it folds all the way around to the other young guy, and he calls. So they're three-handed, and the flop is deuce, tray, seven. So the original guy bets, the kid like in the three seat, whatever it was, two seat. He bets, and then whatever the amount, the amounts make no difference. He bets like half pot or something. She now raises all in. The young guy to her left calls the all in, doesn't reshove or anything like that, because he had a lot of money, a ton of money in front of him, including bills, like tons of hundreds of bills. So he just calls. Now the original kid just calls too. And he still has like 300 or 400 in front of him, maybe 500. Now the turn is another deuce. So it's deuce, tray, seven, deuce. And the original kid fires out like 100. And the other kid now makes it like 300. And the first kid is just like aching. So he shoves, and the other kid calls. The first kid has pocket threes for threes full. The woman still doesn't show her hand. The other kid has pocket deuces for quad deuces on the turn. Now, if a three comes on the river, it's a bad beat. And we all are splitting 50 or 60 or 80 grand or whatever it is. We're like one card away from a bad beat. And the river was like the four of spades, which totally just twists, you know, because one pip away from being the bad beat card. So it turns out, I think the lady, it was either she had kings or aces. So that's what made me think that she had this huge hand, and it makes sense that she goes all in there because it's all unders, and she'd been the initial aggressor preflop. So even if the guy has like jacks or queens or kings or whatever, she's still crushing him. So she goes all in thinking she's going to win the hand, and she has to muck her aces or kings. So that was why I thought, all right, she only played big hands. Every hand I've seen, even before that, she had done it a bunch of times before where she only had big hands like that. And that's why I bet out. But yeah, I'm one card. I'm literally three hands away from a royal at Bally's. Then I'm one card away from a bad B for 80 grand. And then three hands later, I'm one card away from a royal bonus. And I missed them all. I missed all. How can you run that bad?
Yeah, that's out of the norm there. I would think you would have hit one of those.
I mean, something, something. Anyway, one time I think in my entire career I've actually been a part of a high hand somehow, and it was like another guy hit it, but we all got like $10 or something at Jacksonville. Other than that, I've never hit any bonuses or been even close or smelled close to it, except for that one time I had tens full and the guy had quad threes, and if I had hit my 10 on the river, it would have been a bad beat. Other than that, I never hit anything. You've hit high hands, haven't you?
I've had one.
Yeah, all right,
one in Omaha. Yeah, so I'm due for another one.
Yeah, you're due for another one. I haven't gotten any, but you're due for another one.
Of course, you know, you got to be able to play to hit some.
Yeah, it's true.
This particular trip, I mean, I made up for it on the back end of the trip when I went to New Mexico and Colorado. But in Vegas, I was just whipped, you know, from traveling and the stress of the luggage. So I had a couple of early nights the first two nights. Didn't play a lick of poker until our meetup, obviously. And then Thursday, as you mentioned, we were out with some friends, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to play tonight. Going back, and I wasn't expecting to see you in the hotel room. I was just going to drop some stuff off, and I'm like, oh, Chris is here, so I'll watch TV a little bit, and fell asleep, of course. But then woke up, and I'm like, all right, I got to go play. And I had wanted to go play a tournament that night, and I knew Caesars had a 10 o'clock tournament. So I figured they probably had some late registration so I could still make it. So I get over there and got into the tournament. And, you know, we're talking about how the euro exchange rate and how there's not as many Europeans over there playing. I sat down at my table, and I am one of only two Americans at my full table.
Hmm.
Which I thought was really, on one hand, really cool because, you know, you don't get a lot of, we get a lot of tourists here in Florida, but I don't usually run into them in a situation, an intimate situation where, like, playing poker where you're talking to folks. But I thought that was kind of weird, right? And then my table, actually my table didn't break, but it was a big blind, so they had to move me to another table. I get to that table, and once again, I'm one of only two Americans at that table.
Wow.
So it was really kind of cool in one sense, and just kind of odd on the other sense. But at my first table, there was a great situation of a good learning example, I think, and I don't think the player really took it that way, but it was one of the foreign players, a French player, and he was in the 10 seat, you know, and now all poker players hate the 1 in 10 seat for lots of reasons.
Yeah.
But he was in the 10 seat, and he looked a little tired. I don't know if he's been playing all day or whatever, but I was watching him because I was in seat 2 or 3, and he was acting before me. And he kind of gave this, shook his head a little bit, put his cards to the left of him, almost right near the dealer, right? And then the action continued, and next thing I know, they collect all the bets and go to the flop. And before they put the flop out, the guy in the tent is like, "Whoa, where'd my cards go?" And I'm like, "What? I thought that he folded." And he really did look like he folded. He put this card aside, but apparently he must have put his 600 bet in when he did that, and he didn't cap his cards or anything. And the dealer, you know, he put them right where I would put them if I was folding in the 10 seed. And the dealer scooped them up. So then they called the floor over, and then the floor said, "Hey, sorry, it's your responsibility to protect your hands. Your hand's dead." And he's like, "Well, I want my 600 back." It's like, "No, that's not the way it works. It's got to stay in there." And he just exploded on the floor. And they had another floor come over and explain the same thing to him. And then he did the one question that, if you've seen the O.J. Simpson trial, you know, never ask. Never ask a question when you don't know the answer.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Ask anyone at the table." And I'm like, "Do you want to ask me? Because I think you folded."
That's right.
And, you know, so then they gave him a one-round penalty because he was being abusive. He sat back down, and he started whining in French to the player in the one seat, who, and apparently they're friends. And they're like, "Hey, you know, this is English at the table. You're getting one more warning." And so then he got upset about that. And then on the very next hand, he starts talking French again, and the dealer's like, "You know, floor?"
Yeah.
And they're like, "They're still talking in French." And, you know, so I felt bad for the guy. I mean, no one wants to muck their hand. But, again, this is one of those things. This wasn't a egregious error on the dealer's part. He looked disinterested in the hand. He put the cards where the dealer would pick them up, and you lost him. You know, live and learn. But the guy did not want to learn.
Right, and rule number one, protect your cards. Protect your cards. And he didn't protect them.
The next six hands after that, he did not cap his cards.
Oh, jeez.
Eventually, he started putting the cards way to the right of his stack so the dealer couldn't reach him. So at least he got protected then. But, you know, I didn't want to tell the guy. I didn't want to be the jerk at the table and say, "Dude, you just got your cards mucked. Cap your darn cards." And there were a couple other people that were telling him that, and he just, you know. And so, I don't know. Just listen to you folks out there, you know. Take responsibility at the table.
And then it's all to injury, too. He gets a penalty on top of it. So he loses 600, then he loses the penalty, so he's losing his blinds. Just not smart, man. You're going out there to make money and enjoy yourself, not to to have blow-ups and compound the problem with, you know, speaking French. But it was a good trip overall. I mean, you know, we got to see a lot of important people and have some important meetings and played a little bit, had some fun. And, you know, of course you had the debacle, but I'm sure we'll hear more about that on a future show when we talk about your New Mexico, Colorado trips coming up soon.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown.
This is Downtown Chad Brown, and I'm in the studio with Auntie Up.
Senior situation this week.
Senior?
Yep. Well, it came in a senior's event. That's it.
Ah, okay. It's a situation, so I don't really need a pad and pen or anything?
Well, it depends, yeah. But it is a situation.
Okay.
It comes from our good friend Tietza, one of our cruise veterans. This is like a cruise show. You know, we got a cruise guy winning the tournament. We got cruise giveaways. People going to give them away. And now we got a cruise passenger sending our situation of the week.
Cool.
You know. If you're not on any of Poker Cruise, you're not a person.
Yeah, you're missing out.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so this is what Thesa wrote in. It's a $300 seniors event at the Borgata.
Okay.
And I have a hard trouble of time believing that Thesa's a senior. I mean, she's young at heart.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Young in looks, too.
Lots of energy, too, yep.
Maybe this is one of those places where the seniors qualifier is 35 or older.
Yeah, I was going to say, just remember, I'm considered a senior, and so are you now at the Horseshoe in Tunica. So.
Yeah, that's correct, yes. All right, but so she's playing that. She's at 175 entries. Starting stack is 12K, 30-minute levels. By the first break at the end of level 3, she has squiggly 42,000. She's more than tripled her starting stack, right?
Okay.
She's played well all day, built her stack, but took some big hits, ran to a straight flush, set over set, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, we all
go through that.
They redraw at the final 20 players. 18 players get paid, all right? So we're close to the bubble. But then they do one of these bubble saves where they all collect for the two bubble spots. So everybody's technically at least getting their money back at this point.
Okay.
And Tietza says she hasn't played with many of these new folks who sat at her table. So she has, you know, not much of a read here on folks. All right, so we're at level 17. Blinds are 500 ante, and the blinds are 3,000, 6,000.
Wow.
Tietza is our hero in seat 5 in the cutoff seat, again with Squiggly 42, which is just 7 big blinds at this point down, and looks down at Ace King offsuit. And she says in all caps, waiting to ship it.
Yeah.
All right, so here's how the action. Seat 8 is under the gun, huge stack, moves all in. He's a new player to the table. This is his third hand of the table, each of which he pushed all in on. She says she doesn't know him at all, so even though he has pushed the previous two hands, I have to give him credit for a big hand under the gun. This is a seniors event, which makes me give him more credit for hand under the gun. See, she was telling us last week to keep stereotyping, right?
Yep.
She's doing it.
She's doing it.
But she says, hey, I'm still going to ship it. So seat 9 folds. Seat 10, who's another huge stack, but smaller than initial pusher, ships all in as well. Now it folds to us.
Hmm.
And she says, as I tank, number 20 bust, coming over to my table to pick up the bubble money.
Hmm.
So here's her thoughts, and then we'll see what you think. She said, best I'm racing. Give under the gun ace king jack jack or better. Give the other guy tens or better. Could be smaller, but I don't see a reason to push for his life. He has plenty of chips. If neither have an ace, then small aces have folded to their pushes. I have to hit a four flush with my ace. I can't count on the king to a flush. Next hand levels go up to 1,000 ante, 4,000, 8,000 blinds. And that means I have 5,000 big blinds in the cutoff, so I have 8 more hands to see before the blinds come back. My goal is not to min cash, but to win. I would rather give myself a chance and push with others behind me to call with their weak aces or crap rather than me call off my life with two, with a big one for my tourney life. But I could quintuple up. What do you do?
Okay, well, I know what you would do. and I think I would do what you would do. I think I'm folding. And the reason being is because it's not the first player I'm worried about, even though she went on and on about the ultimate under the gun and having a good hand. If he's done it a lot, then he clearly knows he has a huge stack and that he can push these people around, and he's just, even if he's wrong, unless it's pocket aces, he's not that much of a dog anyway, and he's picking up all these pots that he only has to be, you know, right a certain amount of times and everything. So I'm not really worried about him. The second person I'm a little more worried about, because this person knows the same thing we know, so he could easily have a hand that we're racing against. But the other thing is that he could have a hand that not dominates us, but has our outs. If, let's say, the under the gun, or vice versa, the under the gun player has like a pair, now we have fewer outs because the other guy did the same thing we did with ace king. Now he's got our ace and our king, or he's got one of our aces or one of our kings that we need to hit to win if we believe one of these players has a pair. So if there's a pair out, the other player likely has some of our cards, you know, whether it's an ace or a king or both. And it could be a situation where all of our cards are in the mix somehow, or somebody's got kings, and now you've got no kings, and the other guy's got an ace, now you've only got two aces to hit, and if you do, it still might not be good because the other guy might make two pair or whatever. So I really feel like she'd have 5 more big blinds when they go up. I feel like I'm on the button here, right? So I have a bunch of hands. I don't have to put any money in other than the ante. So I really feel like I want to be the first one in with 40,000 rather than the third one in, and knowing that a lot of my outs could be already in other people's hands. So I really think I'm going to let it go. I mean, I'm in the money. And like she said, she wants to win the tournament. Now, I realize that a risk here of going all in with ace king and tripling, more than tripling up.
Quintuple, whatever.
So that could give her a much better chance to win than only doubling up on another hand later on. But I feel like I always want to be the first one in when I'm going all in if I don't have aces or kings or something like that. So in this case, I'm dodging 4 cards and hoping to hit. And I could be woefully behind and have my outs taken too. So I'm folding.
Yeah, what's interesting about this hand is I'm calling with a lot of hands here. but I'm not calling with ace-king.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the difference here. I mean, I absolutely want to quintuple up. This is the kind of opportunity you're looking for when you're short, is to get in there and get lucky, and then you're set. I mean, she'd be up to, what, about 200K? She'd have 25 big blinds, and that's pretty good once you're in the money there to be able to go. But you have to have the odds of actually quintupling up.
Yeah.
And ace-king, while a great hand otherwise and a great hand to shove with or a great hand heads up, I think really shrinks up with the information we have here and how the action's gone. If I'm 6-7 of diamonds, I'm calling probably with that and taking a shot because I know my cards might be live, or at least I have a lot of other outs and things I could do, and it's worth it at that point to quintuple up. But ace-king, I very likely drawing dead here.
I think that I would disagree with you on the other hands calling. I don't think I'm calling anything here unless I have aces or kings, maybe queens. I can't, because the middle guy could very easily have eights, think he's racing against some idiot in under the gun, and now I've got two unders to eights or nines. I mean, that's a very likely holding of somebody.
Well, we're guaranteed we're going to have unders to four of them. So,
no, but I mean, unders to, you're not, that's not right. Unders to other unpaired cards is one thing. If somebody has a pair, I'm not going all in with six and seven, and it's very likely somebody could have eights here or something, and that, I don't want to be two unders to a pair. Two unders to 8-9 is one thing. You're only like 60-40, right. But two unders to eights, you're screwed. Okay, I don't want that.
You're right, but my point is that we have no shot with ace-king. I think those cards are all out.
I don't know about that. I'm just saying one or two might be.
My 6-7 or my diamonds or anything like that.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily saying I would do that, but I'm saying the point I'm trying to make is you got to follow the action. I don't think we've got two people going all in with sixes and sevens.
Yeah.
Somebody has a big pair, and so we're going to have to. The bottom line is we're going to have to get lucky in this hand, right?
Yeah.
So the difference is, do we want to get lucky and quintuple up here when the odds are really thin that we're going to get lucky here? Or do we want to, fold here, not have much fold equity, but put ourselves in a situation where we're shoving, or at least we're just heads up with somebody with a different hand? And on top of that, we have at least five hands to make that decision.
Yeah, I definitely like that scenario better than having to get lucky with 6-7 or any hand, really. Really, you have to get lucky with any hand here. Unless you have aces or kings. And even then, you have to dodge stuff. So, yeah, I like the idea of being heads up and trying to be the first one into the pot, at least. I would fold if I were her.
All right, well, that's what she does. And the flop comes king, king, X. And she says, ugh. And the bubble burst. And she says, the young guns were railing me, scolding me for folding here. And the non-math guys agreed with my fold. And before we talk about that, she said the next hand she had ace-jack suited, push, get called by 6-6, and doesn't catch. Yeah. And she's out min-cashing, not happy.
Yeah. You can't be results-oriented just because kings came on that flop. I think it's the right play. I think it's still the right fold. You know, what if it came 2-4-7? You know what I mean? And then what? Then you win the tournament, and then they say, oh, it was the right play? I mean, I don't know. I don't think there are non-math players. Just for the record.
Yeah, let's not go there. But
really, I can't be results-oriented, right? You can't be results-oriented and say, oh, the king's game, I should have called.
And I don't think she is there. I'm just thinking that she's making a distinction between two sets of minds on this. And I would be interested to hear that whole conversation because I don't really think what I'm doing is... I'm not claiming to be a field player in this situation here. I think the math is pretty clear here that we have thin chances of actually winning this hand. So, and what I think I like about it is the next hand she gets ace jack suited.
Yeah,
not a terrific hand, but your first in, that's a great hand.
Yeah.
First in and push, and I'm not saying you're guaranteed of getting a hand like that if you fold or another situation, but it does prove that you're not at risk for your tournament life if you don't call there, and you have at least five or six shots to get a better situation to stay alive with.
Right. It's not the hand necessarily, it's the situation.
You still have to win with those other hands, I know, but I mean, when you're on a coin flip and you've got six other people that want to flip coins with you. Yeah, maybe one of those other ones is going to be better.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, at worst, you find yourself in the blind and have to call off your ship's blind with some other kind of situation, and then you still got to get lucky, right?
Yeah.
So, but I'm interested, and maybe we can get this discussion going on the forum about this difference between the young guns and the non-math guys. I don't know what I think to say about that. I just, you know, I want to get the conversation going because I think that's, you know, I'm guessing the young guns because they're aggressive and then they don't want to lose any edge whatsoever. But, and then the non-math guys, which I guess are kind of us, are just kind of dopey at the math and are playing with feel instead of doing the calculations and decide to pull. Maybe that's what she's getting at. I don't know.
Yeah. I just think that she made the right, I think she made the right play. I mean, like you said, and I said, the cards that we want to hit the flop, that we need to hit the flop, could be out. And that's the other thing. She didn't tell us what the guys had?
No.
See, that
although she said Ugg, so I'm guessing that she would have won. But
yeah, but even so, I mean, it's for the distinction of what we were processing in our heads of, you know, were our aces out? You know, were our, you know, was there a pair that we need to hit the ace or the king? You know, it would have been nice to know those things. But even so, I just feel like, given the situation and given the action that happened before her, she made the right play.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, and I'm just looking at what I responded to Tietze, and I actually contradicted everything I said. I think I would have, initially I would have called here.
Oh, my God.
But, well, you know, again, that's the beauty of reflection.
Yeah.
And why these hands are always more difficult in the hand of the week or the forum, because we have the luxury of taking forever and thinking through all the things, talking to folks, and come out with a better solution than you're in the heat of the moment by yourself.
Yeah. I mean, and there might have been, if she had more time to play with these players, there might have been a reason to believe the guy in the middle didn't have a hand that she wasn't dominating, you know. But the way it looked, with this other guy constantly shoving, and then somebody in the middle of them shoving with them, you have to think that one of these guys has you beat at that moment, and you don't want to be flipping when one's got you beat and the other one probably has some of your cards. And even not, you know, you don't know for sure that the guy under the gun didn't have a hand, because she was in her mind thinking he did have a hand because he was under the gun. So
yeah, yeah. There's a good chance that the first guy has something like eights and the other guy has jacks, you know. Yeah, so you're ace, yeah, king, you still got plenty more outs. I mean, obviously you got to catch, but again, you know, you got to catch with ace king anyhow.
Yeah,
I mean, it's almost unlikely unless the board double pairs or something that your ace is going to hold up there.
That's right.
But all right, well, Thisa, we appreciate you sending that in, and it has been a while since we send you something great, so we're going to send you a T-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Annie Up Store at annieupstore.com. And everybody else, send your hands of the week to podcast at annieupmagazine.com, and you two might win some great stuff.
All right, I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.